You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
Telling me I got to beware. It's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. James Fetzer. Today's show, the 54th anniversary of the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Jim Fetzer is McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth, an author and researcher. A former Marine Corps officer, Jim Fetzer has published widely on the theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, and evolution and mentality. The founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. His latest books include The Evolution of Intelligence, The 9/11 Conspiracy, Render Unto Darwin, and The Place of Probability in Science, and a lot more books that I don't have listed. We'll have to have him tell us about it. Jim Fetzer and I have just returned from Dallas from a three-day JFK assassination conference hosted by Judith Vary Baker. When Jim called me this morning to accept my last-minute invitation to come on Guns and Butter Live today, November 22nd, he said, "Bonnie, you've got the right guy on the right day." Jim Fetzer, welcome.
Oh, Bonnie, I'm just thrilled to be here. Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful. I think the station is sensational. I think you're wonderful. Your show is celebrated. It's a legend. It's just a real pleasure to be here today, especially.
Well, Jim, it's such an honor to have you on, and thank you so much for the great greeting. We want to get straight on to your, I know you've got a lot of new research information on the Kennedy assassination, but what did you think of the conference?
Well, I thought the conference was quite good overall. However, I do believe Judith tried to pack in too many speakers in the time frame. I think I've organized a good number of conferences myself, and I think it's best to have regular one-hour slots so you have ample opportunity to present and answer questions. She had so many speakers that most of us were reduced to 40 minutes, which is really not enough to allow the question and exchange that are such an important part of these meetings.
Well, I totally agree. I think they should be an hour long, but you know, I was bowled over by some of the speakers were just incredible. Not only yourself, you spoke several times, but I had never heard before Dr. Cyril Wecht. My God, a dynamite speaker. I was so impressed. And then there was Robert Tannenbaum, the attorney that resigned from the I can't think of the name.
The House Select Committee on Assassination.
That's right. That's right. Two great Americans. Very impressive. And there were a lot of speakers. I also got a big kick out of the sons of the CIA. St. John Hunt and Chris Milligan, who is the publisher, of course, of Trine Day, who publishes incredibly good books. They're both, their fathers were both CIA officers. We know about E. Howard Hunt, but it turns out that Chris Milligan's father, actually, when they were in Vietnam, he was replaced by Ed Lansdale. I didn't know that.
Well, Ed Lansdale gets around, we believe. In fact, it was he who positioned the shooters and determined the sequence of shots in Dealey Plaza, Bonnie.
Wow. Well, Jim, let's get into your new research. I know you've got some blockbuster stuff on Lee Harvey Oswald, et cetera, on the fake pictures. Let's just get into it. What do you think is most important today?
Well, I believe we've absolutely shattered the cover-up with our latest discoveries, which include that the Bethesda autopsy photos, which have been widely published and circulated, are not of JFK. In other words, they used someone else's body. We've been able to prove it. This is absolutely devastating. Unfortunately, Robert Grodin appears to have been responsible for distributing these photographs, but we've been able to demonstrate by doing superpositions that they are not photographs of JFK. And Bonnie, I have the superpositions of proofs of the key points I'm going to make available on my blog. So if anyone would like to see what I'm talking about, go to jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. You'll find it's my most recent blog, so it will pop right up. It's entitled JFK Bethesda Autopsy Photos, Not JFK, Oswald Frame, Warren Report a Sham. I think as of today, you can say the Warren Commission report is officially dead, Bonnie. It's taken us quite a few years to demonstrate, but I don't think there's much left after you hear the rest of what I have to report.
Well, Jim, let's go through it. I've got it up here. JFK Bethesda Autopsy Photos, Not JFK. So what can we say about these photos?
Well, what we can say is they were strange from the beginning. You'll notice at the top, and Robert Grodin in his book, The Killing of a President, 1994, was responsible for them getting them out. He's taken great pride in having discovered them, but there are oddities. For example, look at the top photographs, Bonnie. How long is the hair? How much gunk there is? In fact, very, very different than JFK's very well manicured hairstyle. If you take a look at any of the photographs of him in Dealey Plaza before his head was blown off, you realize something's wrong with these photographs. In fact, when the Assassination Records Review Board was doing a deposition of Commander James Humes, who was responsible for the autopsy, and appears to have not only enlarged the neck wound to transform it from a wound of entry to a wound of exit, but to have even taken a cranial saw to the skull of JFK and converted a fist-sized wound into an entire back-of-the-head wound so that he could maintain that it had been blown off by a shot that entered at the base of the back of the head and exited the top of the back of the head in order to convert obvious evidence of a shot that had been fired from in front that actually entered the right temple, blew his brains out the back of his already weakened cranium to the left rear with such force that when they impacted with Officer Bobby Hargis riding there, he initially thought he himself had been shot. So that a question was put to Humes at the request of my collaborators, did they give the patient a shampoo and a haircut during the autopsy? To which Humes, of course, replied, no, 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 no. I mean, of course, it sounds absurd, but there's that much difference between these autopsy photographs and the actual condition of JFK's scalp at the time. In fact, if you scroll down further, Bonnie, you'll see some comparisons with the autopsy photographs and JFK's left profile in the one case and his right profile in the other, and you'll see the disparity there. But notice just below those, we have the superposition where we impose the right profile over the left profile over the left profile of the purported corpse at autopsy, and it's obvious that they are not the same person. In fact, this is complemented by what Jackie and Bobby said at the time, contemplating whether or not to have an open casket during the wake held at the nation's capital. They said, that doesn't even look like Jack. And they decided not to have an open casket. And, of course, it didn't look like Jack because it wasn't Jack.
Well, you know, I'm no forensic scientist, but just looking at the photos, I couldn't agree more. That doesn't look like a Kennedy at all.
Now, we have the interesting case of a fellow by the name of J.D. Tippett, whom Lee Oswald is alleged to have shot in a different part of town. There are many oddities associated with the Tippett shooting. It was actually taking place about 1:10 in the afternoon when Lee Oswald was actually already in the Texas theater buying popcorn from a fellow named Butch Barrows, who's given an affidavit about it that you can find online. So this was set up to frame Oswald. They even planted a wallet. I mean, how many wallets is a man supposed to carry? Because when Lee was arrested at the Texas theater subsequently, he had a wallet that had two forms of identification, one for Alec Heidel, another for Lee Oswald, yet they planted a wallet in relation to the Tippit body. But here's the fascinating part about it, Bonnie. Tippit was shot three times in the torso and then once in the right temple while he was lying on the ground, which is interesting since Jack was also hit in the right temple. A woman, Aquila Clemens, said she had seen the shooting take place and there were two shooters and neither of them looked like Lee Oswald. The first officer on the scene found four shell casings that had been ejected from an automatic. And he put his initials on the shell casings. They were of two different manufacturers, Remington Rand and Western Cartridge, suggesting that, indeed, it was two different weapons that had been used when using the two different types of ammunition. When they later discovered the glitch, because Oswald had a revolver, and it would have been absurd for him to stop and open his revolver and remove the incriminating shell casings, they made a substitution. Only now they had three of one make and one of the other. This is one of many ways in which they manipulated the evidence in this case. Now, Robert Morningstar from New York, a longtime student of JFK, has speculated that because Tippit bore a striking resemblance to JFK, that he might have been shot in order to be used as a body double at Bethesda. But as you'll observe, I note that Tippit was undergoing an autopsy that afternoon by Earl Rose, M.D., who was a world-famous medical examiner. It only began at 3:15 p.m. Central Time. That would already be 5:15 p.m. Eastern Time, and or actually 4:15 p.m. Eastern Time. But the use of his body at Bethesda appears to have been problematical because these autopsies take, you know, 5 or 6 hours as a rule. This man, Earl Rose, is completely a man of integrity. I have the Tippit autopsy report, and frankly, in the autopsy report, he doesn't look that much like JFK. I've therefore drawn the inference that the body that they actually used was one they'd found in the U.S. military, considering the millions of enlisted men. They could find somebody who looks like almost anyone they want. Dennis Davis, who is the non-commissioned officer, was keeping charge of a record of who went in and out of the morgue, had been instructed not to record, not to log in the body of someone described as a major, which was a violation of autopsy protocol, morgue protocol. I believe it was the major they had selected to serve as the replacement for Jack Kennedy in these photographs.
Well, that's interesting, Jim. I've never heard that before because, of course, J.D. Tippit, of course, is the so-called Kennedy lookalike. And he does have a strong resemblance to Kennedy. So that's very interesting that you've run that down. Obviously, he couldn't be having an autopsy in two different places at once.
That's exactly right. But we've discovered more, too, Bonnie, which is equally fascinating. For example, as you scroll down, you'll see the Life magazine cover that was used to frame Oswald in the eyes of the public. He's holding the Mannlicher Connell with which he's alleged to have shot JFK. He's got a pistol belt with a revolver with which he's alleged to have shot Tippit, although I've explained the problems with the shell casings. He's holding a communist newspaper, actually two of them, the Worker and the Militant. It's interesting that a colleague of mine who is an expert on the history of communism said that the philosophies of communism espoused by the Worker and Militant were so divergent that if followers of the one encountered followers of the other, they'd break out in fistfights and even try to kill each other. Jim Mars and I long since did an analysis of this backyard photograph, one of which was shown to Lee Oswald by Will Fritz, who was the homicide detective interrogating him. He said that his face on someone else's body and that he'd be able to prove it with time, given that he knew something about photography. Well, Lee, of course, didn't live to do it, but Jim Mars and I co-authored an article entitled Framing the Patsy, the Case of Lee Harvey Oswald, and concluded it had been staged, as Lee had told Will Fritz. We inferred on the basis of the height, build, and chin, which was a block chin, not Oswald's more tapered chin, but also an abnormality of the right forearm, a kind of lump from a bone that apparently didn't heal properly, that this actually had been Roscoe White, who was a Dallas police officer with ties to the CIA. Larry Rivera, discovered a photograph of Roscoe White in a swimsuit at a beach in the same position as Lee in this photograph, and was able to do this superposition to confirm that indeed the backyard photographs were faked using Roscoe White as a stand-in for Lee Oswald. If you play the short movie there, you'll see how conclusive is the comparison. It's truly fascinating, Bonnie.
You're listening to author and researcher Dr. James Fetzer. Today's show, the 54th anniversary of the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Jim, why don't you give out your Blogspot address again so people who missed it could follow along here?
Absolutely. It's jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, Bonnie.
Okay.
And you'll find it. It's the most recent blog, so just go there and you'll have it at your fingertips.
Now, Jim, have you finished with the Lee Oswald photo? Should we move on to the doorway, or do we want to say some more about...
No, if anyone just plays that short video there, they'll see it's unmistakable that the stand-in for Lee, I mean, he's not only got the little lump, he's the right height, the right size, the right build. He clearly... And he's got the right chin, Bonnie. That was one of the most distinctive features. Roscoe White had the chin. Now, it's interesting that Roscoe was a Dallas police officer with ties to the CIA. In fact, his son, after his death, discovered a diary he kept, which is typical of agents of the CIA. They need to know where you are on any occasion in order to fabricate documents proving you were somewhere else should the need arise to do it. He also appears to be the police officer known as Badge Man on the grassy knoll who fired a shot at the limousine, but it apparently would have hit Jackie. So even though it would have been the easiest shot, they were under strict instructions that she must not be harmed. So he pulled the shot, wound up in the grass opposite the grassy knoll where it was picked up and pocketed by a Dallas police lieutenant.
Okay, Jim, now let's go to, thank you very much for that. Number three, he was in the doorway on your Blogspot.
Yes, this is absolutely completely fascinating. There's an area in this very famous photograph known as the Alchin Six, taken by Associated Press photographer James Ike Alchin. You can see the presidential limousine in the foreground. You can see in the background the book depository. There's an area there in the entryway to the depository that has become an object of a great deal of attention. You can see it here because, ironically, Robert Grodin has spent a lot of time on this, too, where he became a special counsel to the House Select Committee on Assassinations when it reinvestigated the case in 1977-78. Ironically, Bonnie, Grodin, as a special counsel to the HSCA, argued that it was Billy Lovelady who was the figure in the center there and not Lee Oswald, even though previously, a year before, he'd been asserting precisely the opposite. He had a new book with Peter Modell entitled JFK, The Case for Conspiracy, and was even quoted in a Orlando, Florida Star Sentinel newspaper as defending the proposition that Lee was in the doorway during the shooting. But something intervened in the meanwhile, and he reversed his position to argue that it was Billy Lovelady in that position rather than Lee. If you look at that part of the photograph, you can see it's obviously been altered because there's a figure both in front of and behind doorman's left shoulder. So unless he's simply missing his shoulder, which is an anatomical virtual impossibility, this obviously has to be an altered photograph. Notice, too, the man with his hands raised to protect his eyes from the sun. His shirt has been obfuscated. You see that massive white blob. He's clearly wearing a short-sleeve shirt. Well, these both turn out to be crucial because we had previously determined that this was Lee Oswald based upon the height, the weight, the build, the shirt, and the T-shirt. In fact, Bonnie, it's fascinating because when Lee was arrested, his appearance resembled so much the figure in the doorway here. They had him remove his outer shirt and took his mugshot in just his T-shirt. But they resembled one another to the point that Lee used to tug at the collar of his T-shirt and pull it down in a V. And when they photographed him in the T-shirt alone, you can see the V. What Larry has done is to find photographs of Lee and of Billy Lovelady that he's been able to impose on the facial features, so that in addition to the height, weight, build, shirt, and T-shirt, we've now been able to confirm that Doorman, as he's known, has the same facial features as Lee Oswald, too. That's the first of the two images you see. If you go below, you'll see Billy Lovelady does not. The ears are wrong. The jaw is wrong. The nose is wrong. In fact, Billy said he thought it was odd they'd be confused because he was 2 to 3 inches shorter and 15 to 20 pounds lighter. He'd actually gone to the FBI on 29 February 1964 at their request wearing the shirt he'd worn on that occasion, and it was a red and white, a vertically striped short sleeve shirt, which explains why they had to obfuscate the figure there with his hands raised. The shirt would have been so obvious and so distinctive. Larry found suitable photographs of Billy, too, and he's been able to determine that the man with his hands raised was indeed Billy Lovelady. And if you scroll down further, you'll see where he's done a reconstruction of the doorway area in color, where you can see the doorman in the reddish-brown, long-sleeve, richly textured shirt. And standing beside him with his arms raised to protect his eyes from the sun is Billy Lovelady in his red and white vertically striped short sleeve shirt.
And, Jim, of course, we're talking about the Alchins photograph, part of which is the ground floor doorway to the book depository. And the significance of all of this, of course, is that if it is proven and shown, which Jim Fetzer is now doing, that Lee Harvey Oswald was standing in the doorway of the book depository to observe the presidential motorcade, then he could not have been a lone assassin of President John Kennedy.
You're exactly right, Bonnie. That's why this has been such an important issue and why Grodin's role in obfuscating by claiming that he had done a pixel analysis of the sleeves of a shirt he claimed Billy Lovelady was wearing, which is completely different than the red and white vertically striped shirt. Instead, it's a red and black checkered shirt that another figure was wearing in the doorway. Grodin even made photographs of Billy wearing a red and black checkered shirt, which Judith Mary Baker, who sponsored the conference, who was Lee Oswald's girlfriend the summer before he came to Dallas, has shown to be opposite of Grodin's testimony. He said that the red and black checkered shirt was a closer match to the doorman shirt than was Lee's own richly textured shirt he was wearing when he was arrested. But Judith has shown precisely the opposite is the case. In fact, the red and black checkered shirt preserves features that are completely inconsistent with a shirt on doorman, whereas the same study, the pixel study of Lee's shirt, the left sleeve, is a very close match. So Grodin was, for whatever reason, he appears to have been co-opted, giving a testimony that he actually knew himself to be false, given his previous determination that Lee had been in the doorway. I mentioned in passing other students of JFK have arrived at the same conclusion as long ago as Harold Weisberg, who published a series called Whitewash. In Whitewash 2, or Photographic Whitewash, published in 1966, in the last few pages, Weisberg spent a lot of time explaining how the Warren staff was seeking to obfuscate the fact that Lee Oswald had been in the doorway. Even Jim Garrison, the celebrated district attorney of New Orleans, who was lionized in Oliver Stone's magisterial film JFK, had concluded that Lee had been in the doorway. Ralph Sinquet, who founded the Oswald Innocence Campaign, as a chiropractor, was very used to working with people so their clothing would fit better on their bodies. And it was Ralph who convinced me that the key to identifying the man in the doorway was not the facial features, which at that point in time appeared rather indistinct, but rather the height, the weight, the clothing, the shirt, the T-shirt. He was spot on and exactly right. We never anticipated having this new technology that Larry Rivera has pioneered that would enable us to verify that it was indeed Lee Oswald. given there are only two alternatives for the man in the doorway, Bonnie, we have safely concluded that indeed it was Lee Oswald. And precisely as you observe, this not only means he cannot have been the lone demented gunman, but he cannot have even been one of the shooters.
Jim Fetzer, how about we go on to discuss the conspiracy itself? I, on the plane home from Dallas, of course, I met St. John Hunt, son of Lee Howard Hunt, and I read his book, Bond of Secrecy, My Life with CIA Spy and Watergate Conspirator E. Howard Hunt. And I thought I'd take a little bit out of this book that E. Howard Hunt talked about in order to just kick off the conversation about the conspiracy itself, because it's very complicated and people have different ideas about it. Now, there's a filmmaker, Eric Hamburg, who wrote the afterword to St. John Hunt's book called E. Howard Hunt and the JFK Plotters. He actually videotaped a lot of the interviews with E. Howard Hunt. And in St. John Hunt's book, he talks about E. Howard Hunt's identification. He named eight central figures in the conspiracy. And I want to just run them all by you, and we can have a talk about this. E. Howard Hunt named Lyndon Johnson, Kordmeyer, David Atlee Phillips, also known as Maurice Bishop, William K. Harvey of the CIA, Antonio Veciana of Alpha 66, Frank Sturgis, Operation 40, David Sanchez Morales, and Lucian Sarti. And I wanted to kick off the discussion because I think you may have some other ideas about who the actual assassins were. Lucian Sarti is a French Corsican assassin. And according to Eric Hamburg, who interviewed E. Howard Hunt, and he was actually quite knowledgeable about the assassination, read many, many books on it. He may have even worked on the film JFK. I can't remember exactly, but I think so. Now, according to what he said that the eight central figures that E. Howard Hunt named fit in with the research that he had done, and he talked about William K. Harvey, who apparently, from what I know, was the CIA head of the Executive Action Program, which was the assassination program, and that he had a big fight with Robert Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy had William Harvey transferred to Rome. Now, apparently, it was in Europe, and apparently, well, this is very complex, but in Miami, E. Howard Hunt met with Frank Sturgis, and Frank Sturgis talked about the, quote, big event, and that William K. Harvey was involved, and E. Howard Hunt said that William Harvey was an alcoholic psycho and he wasn't going to be in any kind of an operation with William K. Harvey. But according to this book, then William K. Harvey was the one who recruited French Corsican assassins and that they were the shooters in the plaza. Now, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think E. Howard Hunt got it right when he said to his son, St. John, when he believed he was about to die, this was published in Rolling Stone as his last confession, that the chain of command went from Lyndon Johnson to Kordmeyer to David Atlee Phillips to William Harvey and then to David Sanchez Morales. Now, below David, I believe, were the mechanics, their supervisors and coordinators, meaning the actual shooters, who I certainly agree included Frank Sturgis. He appears to have fired the shot that entered Jack's right temple. It was a frangible or exploding bullet that set up shockwaves that blew his brains out the back of his already weakened cranium because he'd previously been hit in the back of the head by a shot fired by an anti-Castro Cuban, Nestor Tony Escadro, from the room closet window of a uranium mining company in the Daltex that was owned by or controlled by the CIA and or the Mossad. Now, it's fascinating, but Richard Hooke has done brilliant work that supports the conclusion that George H.W. Bush was actually in the book depository supervising the three shots that were made with a Mannlicher Carcano. These were the only shots made with an unsilenced weapon, Bonnie, to create the acoustical impression of only three shots having been made. I agree with most of the analysis, but I doubt very much that they used any foreigners. Texans would have regarded Frenchmen as pansies. They wouldn't have thought they would follow through. Now, Antonio Vecchiana, fascinatingly enough, was actually captured in a famous photograph by a Dallas photographer and is captured in the right-hand corner of a color photograph on the cover of my first book, Assassination Science, which I only discovered in following the issue about Rafael Cruz having been in New Orleans in front of the trademark when Lee Oswald was handing out Fair Play for Cuba pamphlets. It was indeed Rafael Cruz, who was indeed the father of Ted Cruz, who was indeed an anti-Castro Cuban, who was indeed in Dallas at the time. And for him to have been there, but also been with Antonio Vecchiana of Alpha 66, among the most vicious of the anti-Castro organizations, on Main Street together just before the vehicle turned from Main onto Houston, indicates to me conclusively that he was on the fringe of the assassination. He was certainly not a shooter. But Donald Trump was widely ridiculed for making the point that Ted Cruz's father was there with Lee Harvey Oswald. We have long since confirmed that to be the case.
You're listening to author and researcher James Fetzer. Today's show, the 54th anniversary of the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, now, Jim, I want to ask you about a person that comes up in the afterword of St. John Hunt's book, that afterword written by Eric Hamburg, and he talks at length about Richard Helms of the CIA, Richard Helms, who was appointed DCI by LBJ once LBJ became president. He seems to be in the shadows of this whole assassination. Do you have any information on him?
Oh, Helms knew what was going on. There's no doubt about that. The fact is that Alan Dulles, whom JFK would retire with great fanfare, no doubt played a role in planning the assassination. But the key, the pivotal player, was Lyndon Johnson, who forced himself onto the ticket in Los Angeles in 1960. He wasn't on Jack or Bobby's long list, much less their short. Jack had already extended an invitation to Stuart Symington to be his running mate, but he gave him overnight to think about it. Bobby went by the Johnson suite with a pro forma gesture, inviting him to run with Jack, never imagining he'd take it seriously. Instead, Lyndon jumped on it. He threatened to expose that JFK had Addison's disease and wasn't expected to live a long, healthy life. But he'd had dalliances with beautiful women, some of whom were spies for East Germany, both of which were true. And he added that if he were not on the ticket, then in his position as the powerful majority leader of the Senate, he would bottle up any legislative proposal set down by the White House, which would be dead on arrival. Bobby and Jack tried to figure a way out of this, but Lyndon had them boxed in, and they had to accede to his demand to be Jack's running mate. When one of Winston's wealthy supporters heard this, he burst into the Johnson suite cursing and swearing, because now LBJ was going to help JFK become president. Bobby Baker took him into a bedroom and explained what they had in mind. He came out all smiles and said he thought that was an excellent plan. Bobby Baker would later declare that Jack would not live out his first term and that he would die a violent death. Lyndon Johnson would send his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination after he had convinced Jack that he needed to travel to Texas to mend fences between warring Democratic factions there.
Wow, that's really something. And as well, in E. Howard Hunt's memo to his son, St. John, he states that the assassination was initially to take place in Miami, but that Lyndon Johnson changed the location to Dallas, citing, quote, personal reasons. Do you know anything about this?
Well, there were two plots that were exposed. The Miami was circumvented by transporting JFK in a helicopter instead of a motorcade. The Chicago event was actually undermined by a report from an FBI informant by the name of Lee, who appears to have been Lee Oswald, who Bonnie not only was recruited by the Office of Naval Intelligence when he was a recruit at San Diego, where I subsequently would be a series commander with 15 DIs and 300 recruits under my command going through the training cycle, but he would be stationed at Atsugi, our most secure base in Japan from which the U-2 overflights were taking place. No one would be stationed there unless their loyalty was absolute. He made a pseudo-defection to the Soviet Union, apparently to provide the information about the altitudes. A summit meeting was forthcoming between Eisenhower and Khrushchev when Khrushchev accused the United States of spying on the Soviet Union. Eisenhower denied it, but Khrushchev was able to produce the pilot, Gary Francis Powers, and parts of the U-2, which they'd been able to shoot down, which, of course, led to the termination of the summit plans and an increase in Cold War tensions instead of a reduction. When Lee returned to the United States after marrying the nurse of the niece of a KGB colonel, he wasn't received as a traitor to the United States, but was greeted by a CIA front organization, which gave him money to relocate to New Orleans himself, while Marina went to Dallas and was residing with the Payne family, Michael and Ruth, who had ties to the CIA, unbeknownst to them. Ruth would subsequently be instrumental in getting Lee a position at the book depository just 2 weeks before the motorcade. In the meanwhile, in New Orleans, he was being sheep-dipped by giving a phony persona as a pro-Castro communist sympathizer in order to set him up for the role of the patsy in Dallas, which is why he was handing out those pamphlets in front of the trademark in the company of Rafael Cruz.
Could you talk a little bit more about the U-2? Now, supposedly that was shot down, but I had some information from someone else that indicated the tank was only half full and it went down on its own.
Well, that's very good, Bonnie. Apparently, the Soviets had been trying to shoot down, but they didn't know the altitude and couldn't succeed. Now, Fletcher Prouty is the source of the story that actually the CIA had shorted the tank, the fuel tank in the plane, so that it appeared to the pilot that it was full when it was not. It was only partially full. So we have two alternative explanations about how the plane may have been brought down. If it wasn't shot down, then it did run out of fuel and crashed on its own. And frankly, both are about equally plausible. I need to add, by the way, in regard to the Chicago incident, that when Lee was apprehended and killed, Wagoner Carr, who was the Attorney General of Texas at the time, launched his own investigation, discovered almost immediately that Lee was working as an informant for the FBI, that he had informant number 179, and that he was being paid $200 a month right up to the time of the assassination, which ties in with an FBI informant having tipped off to the plan for an assassination attempt in Chicago. Lyndon would have preferred Dallas, of course, because he had complete control. In fact, Bonnie, it's fascinating. One of the documents now that's just been released reveals that the mayor of Dallas at the time, Earl Cabell, who was a brother of the Lieutenant General Air Force, Charles Cabell, who was deputy director of the CIA at the time of the Bay of Pigs, who together with the other deputy director, Richard Bissell, were dismissed by JFK when he discovered it had been a bait and switch. There had been no expectation that this ragtag band was actually going to succeed. The agency had already discovered that the Soviet Union had learned the date of the invasion and had notified Castro. So Castro, the Soviet Union, and the CIA all knew. Castro knew we were coming. The only key person who did not know was John F. Kennedy, who undoubtedly would have called it off. So that we're in the fascinating situation that for years and years we were unable to obtain the W-2 forms for the alleged assassin of the President of the United States, when they only became available after they developed sufficient technology to fake it and then release it, because otherwise discovering he'd been paid $200 a month right up to the time of the assassination would have blown his cover. He would have no longer been a plausible candidate as the patsy.
Now, Jim, another question about that U-2 flight. Now, that was when Eisenhower was president, right?
Yeah.
And wasn't an, a friend of mine has done a lot of research on this, and he says that Eisenhower wanted to have a rapprochement or some kind of a detente with the Russians, and that sending these U-2s over there, I can't remember the story exactly, but maybe that Eisenhower had stopped the U-2 flights, but they continued them, and they had this U-2 go down over that it was Dulles that defied Eisenhower. Do you know anything about this?
Oh, I think that story is very, very plausible, that the agency was resisting control. In fact, when Jack, one of the motives for taking out Jack, I mean, it was inspired by Lyndon's desire to accede to the presidency, in which position he could control the subsequent course of events. He would appoint his close friend and ally, Edgar, the FBI, as the sole investigative agency to cover it up, where the FBI never even questioned the 10 closest witnesses to the limousine. Others nearby weren't asked the crucial questions to reveal the important information they had. And if by some chance it got into the transcript, they simply edited it out. Dulles, no doubt, was playing games behind the scene and resisting. Jack was putting the covert ops of the CIA under the control of the Pentagon to curtail the agency. Neither liked that. The Joint Chiefs were upset because he'd not invaded Cuba, contrary to the unanimous recommendation. He'd gone ahead and signed an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union, contrary to their unanimous opposition. Now he was going to pull our forces out of Vietnam, where they felt a stand had to be taken against the expansion of international godless communism. The agency has been a renegade for all too long, Bonnie. It's been a travesty, committing coups and assassinations around the world, more than 80 in number. Most Americans first became aware of Iran in relation to the embassy hostage crisis, which William Casey, who was Ronald Reagan's campaign manager, manipulated to the detriment of Jimmy Carter. They knew that if the hostages were to be released before the election, that Carter would win in a walk. So they negotiated arms for hostages on the grounds that the Iranians not release the hostages until after the inauguration, which was exactly how it played out. But most Americans think this was some overt act by the Iranians that was just a unjustified or unwarranted, when in fact the CIA had executed its first coup abroad in Iran in 1953, carried out by Kermit Roosevelt, who was a cousin of Teddy, to take out the democratically elected government of Iran and replace it with a dictatorial figure, the Shah. We have done this in many other countries. Our pretensions to be promoting democracy and freedom are ludicrous. Consider that our efforts to take out Bashar al-Assad from Syria. Most Americans to this day do not understand that Assad is the democratically elected president of Syria, and he's supported by 80% or more of the Syrian people, a far greater popularity than our current president or even most of our most recent. So, you know, the hypocrisy of the United States, this is also manifest in 9/11, which was an orchestrated event that was brought to its compliments of the CIA, the neocons, and the Department of Defense, most of whom were dual U.S.-Israeli citizens and the Mossad. The objective was to instill fear into the American people, to support wars in the Middle East, to take out the modern Arab states that served as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the entire region, and eventually to confront the Persian nation of Iran. Wesley Clark revealed the agenda when he gave a speech at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco in 2007, revealing the plan to take out the governments of seven countries in the next 5 years, beginning with Iraq and Libya, ending with Syria and Iran. It did not play out that way because of the intervention of Russia with the support of Iran. ISIS forces, which, believe it or not, Bonnie, we created. ISIS was created by the Defense Intelligence Agency in 2012 with the support of John Brennan, the director of the CIA, Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State at the time, and Barack Hussein Obama, president. Michael Flynn, who was the head of the DIA, opposed the creation of ISIS. And because of that, John Brennan recommended to Barack Obama that he ought to fire Michael Flynn, which was done. But it wasn't because Flynn was a traitor. It was because Flynn was actually standing up for the principles for which the Constitution is supposed to stand. He's received a very bad press, from a media that is almost completely under the influence of the CIA. In fact, William Colby, in 1975, in testimony to Congress, explained that the agency owns everyone of significance in the media. At that time, there was no distinction between the mainstream and the alternative media, where his revelation was followed by Carl Bernstein's publication in Rolling Stone in 1977, entitled The CIA and the Media, where he reported that high officials of the agency were boasting that their greatest successes had been with Time Life, the New York Times, and CBS. If you controlled Time Life, the New York Times, and CBS in that era, you virtually had a lock on the American news. And today, the situation is overwhelmingly worse.
Well, that's exactly right, Jim. And I found out from my friend Barbara Honecker at the Dallas conference that the famous quote from William Casey, she was in the meeting taking notes, and she is the source of William Casey's famous quote when he's asked by Ronald Reagan how he wanted to run his department and what he wanted to accomplish for the future. Quote, Casey said, "Our aim is that as soon as when the American public believes everything that the American public believes is false, we will know that we have accomplished our job," something to that effect.
That's right. That's right. He said, and Barbara Honegger confirms, that our disinformation campaign will be a success when everything the American people believe is false. I mean, isn't that stunning, Bonnie? American people believe the government is there to benefit us, to keep us informed, to look out for our best interest. But actually, the situation is something more like the opposite, as difficult as that may be to believe.
Now, Jim, it's at 1:46. We've got like maybe 10, 11, 12 minutes. And because I so rarely do a live show, I was thinking maybe we should let some of the Guns and Butter listeners in on the conversation. What do you think?
I'd be pleased to do that, Bonnie. Please do that.
Wonderful. Give us a call at 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. If you have a short question or a short comment for Jim Fetzer, today, November 22nd, the 54th anniversary of the assassination of President John Kennedy. So please give us a call, 1-800-958-9008. Well, Jim, what astounds me when I look into this is how many groups of people absolutely viciously hated John Kennedy. The Cubans, the CIA, the military-industrial complex, the list goes on and on and on. And when I was in Dallas just a few days ago, my host drove me by the Kennedy Memorial in downtown Dallas, and I was horrified. It's a little plaque on the ground, and it's surrounded by a high white concrete wall. It looks like a prison.
Yes, that's very perceptive on all counts, Bonnie. In fact, they've done a lot of rearranging of features of Dealey Plaza to make it more difficult to conduct research, which includes moving light posts, for example. In a brilliant study of the extant version of the Zapruder film, John P. Costella, Ph.D., who's a physicist with a specialty in electromagnetism, the properties of light and of images of moving objects, he discovered that when they reconstructed the film, they put the Stemmons freeway sign in improperly. So there's a whole series of frames in which the Stemmons freeway sign is in the wrong position. In my presentations about the overview of the assassination, I show that phenomenon. He also discovered that the blood spray had been painted in, that it disappears in three frames, which are at 1/18th of a second apiece, or a sixth of a second, and that's quicker than a piece of lead, if you dropped it from JFK's forehead, would have taken to hit the floor of the limousine. Also, they blacked out the blowout at the back of the head. They altered the x-rays. David Mantic, MD, PhD, who's board certified in radiation oncology, entered the National Archives already in late 1992, telling me in advance he thought he'd discover both that the X-rays had been altered on the one hand and that there'd be evidence of a second shot to the head on the other. He was able to establish both. They altered the X-ray by using a material far too dense to be human bone to exclude the fist-sized blowout that had been first observed by Clint Hill when he rushed up to push Jackie back into the back seat. That actually was taking place when the limousine was motionless, because William Greer, after Jack had already been hit twice, once in the back, fired from the top of the Daltex, and a second time in the throat, fired from inside the triple underpass, pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt to be sure he would be killed. Then he was hit in the back of the head by that one of the three shots fired from the Daltex, slumped forward. Jackie eased him back up and was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple by that frangible exploding bullet fired from the intersection of the triple underpass and the picket fence by Frank Sturgis. Sturgis, by the way, would acknowledge having shot JFK when he came to New York City to murder Marita Lawrence, who had been a mistress of Fidel, who'd been traveling with some of the gunmen on their way to Dallas. When she discovered what was going on, she wanted no part of it and left. In order to ensure that she not testify before the HFCA, Sturgis was dispatched to murder her. When he broke into her apartment, New York City Gold Shield Detective Jim Rothstein put his .38 to Sturgis's head and his partner to his heart. They took him into custody. Rothstein gave him the throwaway line, "Nice shooting." And Sturgis acknowledged that he'd shot JFK, that he'd done it because he'd betrayed the brigade at the Bay of Pigs, which was false, but an impression the CIA allowed to stand lest they divert their hostility upon the agency itself, and that he'd had dalliances with beautiful women, some of whom were spies with for East Germany, which, of course, was completely true. So, you know, we have a lot of information here. Because Marita survived, she, in closed testimony, was able to give the HFCA two boxes of documents about the assassination. So they actually knew what had taken place, which makes it all the more disheartening when they performed a complete cover-up. They even altered the medical evidence. Remember, there's this fist-sized blowout scene at Parkland. Clint Hill describes it. It's even in the Kennedy Detail, a recent book about the performance of the Secret Service in Dallas, where he talks about describing this fist-sized, gaping, bloody blowout at the back of his head.
Huh? Who did? Okay.
Clint Hill.
Okay. Jim, we've only got a couple of minutes more, and I've got a couple of callers on the phone.
Oh, for it.
All right. Well, we've got Richard in Berkeley. Go ahead, Richard. What's your question for Jim Fetzer?
Well, I have a couple of questions tied together. Why is it so difficult to disseminate this real information on the JFK assassination? And is more known by the general public abroad than the general public in the United States?
Yeah, you're absolutely right on both counts, because the media has been infested by the CIA. It was called Operation Mockingbird. In fact, when William Colby testified in 1975 to Congress that the agency owns everyone of significance in the media, he was speaking the truth, and the situation has only grown much worse. Most of the newspapers of the country don't even have investigative journalists any longer. They simply take the line that they're supposed to disseminate. I refer to the New York Times these days as the Langley Newsletter. You can't get the truth about any significant issue from ABC, CBS, NBC. CNN is virtually CIA 24/7. You can find, identify 100 of those who run CNN, and they're all dual U.S.-Israeli citizens. It's completely shocking. MSNBC, in my opinion, is CIA light with a feminist twist, with Rachel Maddow, who my wife adores. I used to think Rachel was terrific until I discovered how much what she was reporting was divergent from the truth.
Okay, thank you, Richard. Now we've got Mark in Berkeley. Go ahead, Mark.
Oh, thank you very much. I understand that there were several audio recordings of the assassination, which sounded like more than the three shots that were maximum possible by even a real marksman, never mind a clown like Oswald. but I understand they were analyzed and found to be not echoes, that there were actually more than three shots, and it was proved scientifically in England and in the U.S. I don't know if you have any information on that.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. There was a shooter on top of the county records building. There was a shooter inside the triple underpass. There was a shooter on the grassy knoll. There was a shooter at the intersection of the triple underpass and the picket fence. There was a shooter in the Dow Tex. In the Dow Tex, there was a shooter in the book depository. Actually, that was Lyndon's personal hitman, Malcolm Mac Wallace, who murdered a dozen people for Lyndon, including one of his own sisters. The recording you're talking about was by a motorcycle patrolman who had his mic locked on. If you listen and study the audio tape, it's indicative of as many as 8 or 9 shots anyway. I believe 8 to 10, possibly even more, were actually fired during the assassination. But because only the one was with an unsilenced weapon out of the Dow Tex, it created the acoustical impression that only 3 shots had been fired. Now, the House Select Committee studied the audio tape, and initially they subjected it to tests. I talked with Donald Thomas at a conference on JFK in Dallas years ago, where I was the co-chairman, as to whether the microphones they arranged were sufficient to discriminate between shots fired from the Dow Tex and the book depository. He acknowledged, what I was certain was the case, they were not. They only allowed them to test for shots from 2 locations, the grassy knoll and the vicinity of the book depository, to obfuscate the importance of the evidence. Because of this audio evidence, the HSC concluded that he had probably been assassinated by a conspiracy. But believe it or not, there's an unsigned letter in the National Archives that disavows that finding in the National Archives, the finding of conspiracy, which means we're left with the Warren Commission report, which has been demonstrated to be hopelessly inadequate. I mean, Lee Oswald was framed. You had Roscoe White standing in for him. He was actually in the doorway. We've been able to confirm the deepest, darkest secret of the Warren Commission. Even the body that we see in the autopsy photographs is not the body of JFK. In my opinion, today, the Warren Commission is dead.
Okay, Jim, we've got 2 more callers, but I don't think we're going to be able to fit them in. And I have to make a quick announcement. I met in Dallas the producers of a new movie on the JFK assassination called The Searchers, a film by Randolph Benson. It's playing one night tonight, November 22nd, at the Roxy in San Francisco, starting at 7 p.m. Interviews with John Judge, Cyril Wett, Mark Lane, Jim Mars, etc., etc. That's tonight at 7 o'clock at the Roxy in San Francisco. One night only, and I believe the Roxy is at 3117 16th Street. Oh my gosh, we're running out of time. Doggone it. Okay, Jim Fetzer, thank you.
I so appreciate the invitation anytime at all. If you want to have any more callers, I'd be very pleased. You just let me know. I'll be here.
Wonderful. You've been listening to Dr. James Fetzer. Today's show has been the 54th anniversary of the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Shoot me an email at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Go to our website, gunsandbutter.org. Thank you so much.
And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying?
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part two of a fine new collage by Chaz K. on how to respond to the environmental crisis. I hope you'll stay tuned. Virtual Renderings, also known as Chaz K, is back, as we happily announced last week. Our premier creator of progressive/radical audio collages has released a new one on our environmental crisis and on our personal and collective responses to the crisis. It's on those responses of ours that today's second and final installment focuses. We heard part one last week, with a mixture of music, poetry, and especially serious discussion by ecologists. That first half focused on the urgency of our environmental crisis and on the cause of the crisis, which is industrial civilization itself. A quick digression from an incurable English major. That's me. In England of the early 18th century, there were four great social and literary virtues: judgment, knowledge, wit, and taste. And I think Chaz K. and this collage had all four virtues in spades. For example, Chaz K.'s title is An Earth-Toned Collage of Collages. Now, instead of a collage of collages, he could have called it a meta-collage. But he didn't. 10 points extra credit for that. Today's installment focuses on the need to readjust our whole way of conceptualizing humans' relationships with all the other parts of the natural world. That is, the collage calls upon us to undergo a radical paradigm shift. And to their great credit, nobody in the recording uses that hackneyed term, paradigm shift. 10 extra points awarded for that, too. And no offense to all the good people in Hackney. But to return to madness. The original collage examined the seriousness of the crisis. That part we heard. Now the collage starts exploring what kinds of action might or probably won't produce good results. Spoiler alert, no clear, effective plan of action is obvious. For reasons of time, we will skip over much of this section and will focus on the third part of the composition, the need to reconceive our species' relationship with all the other species of our shared planet. Let's start.
How the market is not like a tropical forest. When layers of leaves, high canopy, mid-level broads and fans, short shrubs below, where herbs beneath them and moss on the floor catch light. Fungi in the soil recycle it all back to the top. Every conceivable niche is filled or overfilled, divinely superfluous beauty. In the market, everyone targets the center. It levels to a three-body problem with strange attractors looping in useless eddies. Work is taxed, capital let free to accumulate and be skimmed off. More like an overgrazed pasture, where each generation of Forb is poorer than the last. It's an act of conjuring. The only real product is money, from money. The invisible hand is in your pocket.
brushing is violence, and so is your silence when it's rooted in compliance. To stand firm in loving the fire.
If we could go back far enough, there's the history of the witch burnings. Most of the witches that were burnt were actually healers that were burnt. One of the bits of evidence that the church used to demonstrate being in some relationship with the devil was that if a woman, because women were not allowed education, if a woman was able to heal somebody and they didn't have the right training, because they couldn't have the right training because they couldn't read, the only way they could do that would be because the devil was doing the work for them. So if you were healing with herbs and you weren't given permission by the power elite, if you weren't a doctor, just the fact of healing somebody with herbs, if you were in the wrong century, in the wrong town, you were going to get burnt for it.
That's from the garden to the farthest, prayer made of stardust. Find your healing in the music that calls you, the voice that enthralls you. What do you belong to? Eyes up, there's the setting of the sun. Give thanks to each and every one. The lesson is the medicine woman. Medicine man. Walk in with grace. I know your face and I trust your hands. Medicine woman. Medicine man. Walk in with grace, I know your face, and I trust your hand.
The word radical. Now, I always have to look this one up, because there are different ways of spelling radical. This is the botanical way of spelling radical. And the radical is the growing root tip of a bean sprout. The growing basal cap of the root, which is one of the strongest forces in nature. Without the botanical radicals, soil wouldn't work properly. It wouldn't be aerated. There wouldn't really be life in the soil. It's the radical of the growing plants which are turning the soil and allowing stuff to happen. If you've ever seen an oak tree or any tree growing through a boulder which is cracked in half, I'm sure you've all seen this. It's not growing through a cracked in half boulder. It cracked the boulder in half. And it was in the way, so it came through. Have you ever seen shepherd's purse or something equivalent breaking a sidewalk? It didn't grow in the crack. It produced the crack from underneath. Very quiet, very low-key, not on the surface very radical, but if we weren't spraying the sidewalks all the time, it would just take a few years for things as simple and as profound as the shepherd's purse to completely recycle the concrete.
One of the things, the school system is basically about 100 years out of date. And Bucky Fuller made that point. He said, churches run 500 years behind the times. You know, schools 100 years behind the times, and so on. And I thought it was fascinating, because right after I read that, the Catholic Church reopened the heresy case against Galileo and found him innocent. You know, but it was like about 500 years to the day, you know, that happened. So that thing is, you know, that whole dynamic about us being the most intelligent people, about this entropy thing and all of that stuff, it's basically just not accurate. And it came out of old viewpoints in England, really, in the 19th century, when they were kind of the apex of scientific study. But it's just when you start to get that you live in a world where every living organism has a neural network as sophisticated or sometimes even more so than our own, that they have greater neural net capacity than we do, that in essence their brain is significantly larger, even though they might not have an organ that looks like the brain, they'll have a neural network that is very, very similar to our own. Once you start getting all of that, it not only undermines the entire reductive worldview, but it's terrifying to people who don't really know how to reach outside of themselves and communicate with another life form, even other human beings.
And I think it's one of the reasons why our culture has such a hard time coping with herd lists is that one of the many reasons they have a hard time coping with herd lists is that we bridge so many realms, we bridge so many worlds. And when we're on a good day, we bridge those worlds really well. And let's acknowledge we all have bad days, but on the good days, we are, as a movement, as a field, characterized by synergy, characterized by cooperation between plants and humans, between practitioners and their patients. No therapeutic endeavor can possibly be value-free. It's just we pretend it can be. You know, we're either just treating a hemorrhoid or dispensing something. Actually, any time that you're involved in the transformative work of real healing, facilitating the plants doing the real healing, we're involved in a very profoundly radical transformation of the human soil. Involved in a profound marriage between the plants and humans and everything else. Actually, working at the interface, which is the evidence of the fact that we are all one. Herbalism is ecology in practice. So anytime you give anybody herbs, anytime you take herbs, anytime you talk to people about herbs, you're being profoundly radical, profoundly transformative, profoundly irritating to the dominant paradigm.
People have been so inculcated in a lot of these beliefs. It's like in the United States now, we only have a choice between Christianity and science, and those are the kind of two monolithic belief systems that have been fighting it out. You know, neither one is exactly useful in its present form. But the thing that happens in the school system, there's this sort of thing like, oh, we have to be rigorous, we have to do this, we have to, you know, be based on science and the fundamental stuff. But the problem is they're still using models that are extremely old, and everybody's inculcated in that belief system. So everybody has seen parents shut down their children. If children say, well, that plant over there is sad, you know, the parents will go, oh, honey, plants don't have feelings. It's a really common thing for children to be told. And so it sort of starts earlier, because the invisible world is something people don't know much about, and they're afraid to encourage it in their children because they also don't understand children very well for the most part. But really, once you get into the school system and they start dividing all of the subjects up into blocks, like chemistry this time, physics this time, you know, and you start having these sort of separate divisions, and the children become inculcated in this experience of the world being basically dead, and just it's sort of a resource that human beings can use, and it has to happen over and over again. Children naturally experience the world as alive and intelligent and aware. They have to be trained over and over and over out of that belief before we finally let go. And the longer we go into the school system, the longer we're in there, the worse it gets. Until finally, a lot of people graduate from college and however long they've gone in it, and they just don't know who they are anymore. They experience life as meaningless, and hence the Prozac industry.
As the world burns, the old masters, we hear, avoided challenging the status quo, as they also avoided contact with women and refrained from social activism. Considering the crimes of history, the Buddha wondered what to do. Thus, we sit, pursuing personal self-cultivation, serenity as proof of some transcendental virtue. In the great Kalpa fire, when all is consumed, is it consumed as well? Sit with this. Outside, the peasants pass buckets hand to hand.
And in the gray light that shapes the dawn, we see the things that we believe in. Light is substance and shadow form. Such sweet darkness to shape the things that we believe in. Oh, maiden mama crone, oh, maiden mama crone, oh, maiden mama crone.
So the basic premise of my work is that our world is built on a story, a mythology, or even that our world is a story. Understanding that that itself is a story, but one that's been useful to me in understanding things. So, like, on a pretty obvious level, things like nation states, corporations, money, they don't have any physical reality except what we create through our agreements about them. So you could very easily say that those things are a story. And even our understanding of how change happens in the world, what a self is, what's important in life, all of these things are conditioned by the narratives that we grow up in. So basically, the story of separation is what I call this underlying meta-narrative or mythology that says, yeah, who you are is a separate being in a world of other, kind of like this bubble of psychology bouncing around inside a flesh robot, and separate from other selves out there, and fundamentally separate from nature too, in that there are these generic particles out there, these masses, these arbitrary forces of nature that we need to protect ourselves against and someday master and overcome and transcend and rise above nature. So this is all part of the story of separation, separate from each other, separate from nature. And it's a story that isn't working very well anymore, at least. Maybe we once could pretend that it was working well and that we were on the verge of, you know, finally conquering nature, transcending death, synthesizing food, going off into space and achieving technological utopia. But that's getting harder and harder to maintain that pretense. And the crises that are built on that story. First and foremost, the ecological crisis that comes from seeing nature as just a bunch of stuff. That crisis is ejecting us from that story into first, like you said, the space between stories where we don't know what's real anymore. We don't know what's true anymore. We don't know who we are anymore, maybe as individuals, maybe as a species. And then into a new and actually very ancient story that offers different answers to those questions. Who are you? Well, the totality of all my relationships, a mirror of all of nature, a mirror of the cosmos. What's important to contribute to something greater than myself. So it offers a completely different navigating system and understanding of who we are and the way the world is. So that, for example, it becomes obvious that what we do to the world, we do to ourselves because we're not separate from the world. What happens to another being is happening to us inescapably, no matter how high a wall we build between us and no matter how developed our technologies of insulating and controlling are. It can't protect us because what's happening to the whales is happening to us inescapably. So that's the basic picture.
To shape the things that we believe in.
Issue in the transition is to know that ecosystems are collapsing, species have been driven to extinction, economies are collapsing everywhere, entire societies, like in Syria, if half your people are living in refugee camps somewhere else, you know, that's a collapse. It's a social collapse. I think in the towns of Baltimore and in the towns of Missouri, we see a social collapse. But the key is not to respond to either fear or panic or hate. Because that is what is triggered for those who would like to maintain power in this period. When I hear the speeches of your presidential candidates, you know, based on fear and hate, they are actually making sure there can't be a transition. So the transition needs, instead of fear, it needs hope. Instead of hate, it needs love. The second is that this transition cannot happen while we think peacefully. We all have limits. Either I can start a garden, or I can be a good teacher, or I can be a wilderness protector. But even while we play our little role in our care for the earth, we have to be deeply aware of the web of life. And it's only when we see those interconnections at every step, we will stop doing what society has done for too long, competing with each other. Climate movement competing with the agricultural regeneration movement, the labor movement having to compete with the environmental movement. Too long have we been pitted against each other by those who thrive on divide and rule. The third very, very important aspect of the transition is, you know, 250 years of paradigms in economy and science and technology have literally groomed generations to think that, oh my God, what's going to happen if I don't have a job? Oh my God, what's going to happen when we run out of oil? Oh my God, what's going to happen if I've got to return to the village? What's going to happen when there's no electricity? The only way we'll make this transition is by looking at small farmers and their societies, looking at indigenous people and their societies, first developing respect for them, not looking down on them as primitive, but realizing that they created a very, very large footprint with a very high culture. We can only make this transition as an earth family. We can only make this transition through the joy of living, not being married to the junk that industrial society has created.
Baby, you and I've got a lot to learn. Don't want to waste another day. Maybe you gotta lose it all. Thank you.
with the words Don't Wait ends Chaz K's new composition, An Earth-Toned Collage of Collages, and also ends this installment of New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Our show's webpage is newworldnotes.blogspot.com, and there you can find a link that will get you, absolutely free, the uncut original version of today's collage and 111 others by collage artist Virtual Renderings, or Chaz K. Same dude, different monikers, and no offense to Monica Lewinsky, the only party in the entire Bill Clinton impeachment proceedings to act with any judgment, knowledge, wit, and taste. So hats off to Monica, if you can still afford a hat. But I digress. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, you'll hear the speech given by Professor Michel Chesedovsky at the Toronto hearings in 2011. He's also the co-founder of my favorite website, globalresearch.ca, out of Montreal. And he's also the author of several books. If every American understood what he's talking about here, things might be very different. The speech has been slightly edited due to time constraints. So here he is, Michel Chesedovsky.
What I'd like to address in my presentation are the broad consequences of 9/11 with regard to U.S. military doctrine, but more broadly, the pretext and justification which the lies surrounding 9/11 have given to waging a war of conquest under the banner of what we call the war on terrorism, or the global war on terrorism, which we could call the GWAT. The global war on terrorism was launched late at night by the war cabinet, which was formed in the afternoon of 9/11, and a decision was taken to declare war on Afghanistan as a state sponsor of the 9/11 attacks, in other words, a sovereign country somewhere in Central Asia, on the grounds that Al-Qaeda and mastermind Osama bin Laden was behind these attacks, and consequently, Afghanistan, as hosting Al-Qaeda, was responsible for a military attack on the United States of America. And what is more important is that the following morning, without any evidence, nobody knew who had done it on the same day, but the following morning, Eastern European time in Brussels, the Atlantic Alliance met and invoked Article 5 of the Treaty of Washington, which essentially states that an attack on one of its members constitutes an attack on all of its members under the concept of collective defense. Now, immediately we see unfolding this notion of preemptive war, that this was an act of defense. This was a decision on the part of NATO to defend itself against the attack of a foreign country. And as a result, NATO didn't actually declare war on the 12th. It waited until barely 2 or 3 days before, based on some State Department document which was composed and never verified. And then they said, yes, we now rubber stamp the decision that we took tentatively on September the 12th. But needless to say, this tragic event of 9/11 was used as a pretext and justification to wage war on an impoverished country in Central Asia. There were diplomatic exchanges between Afghanistan and the United States. People say the Taliban, but this was the government of Afghanistan, whether we like them or not. And they said, I think on two occasions, if there's evidence that bin Laden is behind these attacks, we'd be happy to hand him over to American justice. And George W. Bush said, we don't negotiate with terrorists. That was his response. So that avenue was not taken. And anybody who has a minimal understanding of military planning will know that you don't plan a large-scale theater war in a matter of 4 weeks. This conference took several months to prepare. And imagine, anybody who has looked at military documents knows that it takes several months and sometimes years to prepare a war of that size. So that the war on Afghanistan was in the pipeline well before 9/11. And 9/11 was the pretext and justification for waging this war, using what former Central Commander General Tommy Franks calls a mass casualty producing event. It must be a military concept, a mass casualty producing event, which in the logic of Operation Northwoods, which was the secret plan to attack Cuba based on attacks in the Miami exile community with casualties. And that document envisaged precisely that. And then they said that the deaths of Cuban Americans would create a useful wave of indignation, which would then trigger a pretext and a justification to wage war on Cuba. That plan was never implemented. It was presented. It was under the Kennedy administration. It was presented by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You can look at it. It's a declassified document. Robert McNamara at the time was Secretary of Defense, and I think that the White House turned it down. But the concept is certainly on record. Now, what I'd like to address is the fact that this event of 9/11 initiated what we might call the Al-Qaeda legend, namely that Al-Qaeda and his leader, Osama bin Laden, constitute the outside enemy in the eyes of public opinion. And we saw that in the wake of these tragic events, immediately there was a mass mobilization of public opinion. And I don't think even sectors in Canada, I think everybody joined the bandwagon. virtually everybody, even trade unions, progressive organizations, and a few dissenting voices. My first reaction on the morning of 9/11, when George Tenet, head of the CIA, announced that Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden was behind it, was twofold. One, of course, I was wondering how he could actually have done it from his hospital bed in Rawalpindi, because he was hospitalized, but we didn't know that at the time. But I then said to myself, but if Al-Qaeda is behind these attacks, who is behind Al-Qaeda? And I knew from the research I'd conducted on Yugoslavia in particular, but going back to the Soviet-Afghan war, that Al-Qaeda was an intelligence asset of the CIA. And this was amply recognized in numerous documents. And the response of the U.S. intelligence community was, yeah, we supported him, but he went against us. Okay? You can read that. I'm quoting literally from press reports, from intelligence reports. It's when an intelligence asset goes against his sponsor. Now, we were the sponsors of Al-Qaeda. It was for a good cause. It was to fight the communists in the Soviet-Afghan war. And we sent in the Mujahideen. We trained them in these CIA camps in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We set up the religious schools, the madrasas. We then contracted with our friends in Saudi Arabia to send in Wahhabi missions into Afghanistan to train these people. This is fairly well documented. But the understanding of the intelligence community is he turned against us in the wake of the Cold War, the jihad, then started to target the Western world, and that 9/11 was an attack by Muslim terrorists. Now, the blowback, I can tell you that the blowback is a fabrication. It's an absolute fabrication, and that's absolutely crucial to an understanding of how this event then led to shifts in U.S. military doctrine, even in nuclear doctrine. Even in the use of nuclear weapons, because they even say we might use a tactical nuclear weapon, a mini nuke, against Bin Laden or against Saddam Hussein. I know, I've read those documents inside out, and they actually say that. Now, when you look at a mini nuke, a B-61-11, it's something of the order between one-third and six times a Hiroshima bomb. So it's no small bomb. It's a bunker buster bomb. And that means you don't take out Osama bin Laden in his cave or in his hospital in Rawalpindi. Now, anybody who's been to Rawalpindi knows that it's a place which is swarming with U.S. military advisors. So how did he get into his hospital on the 9th of September for his kidney problem? And then when was he released from hospital? Either on the 10th or 11th. But his whereabouts were known. Donald Rumsfeld said, we don't know where he is. It's like looking for a needle in a stack of hay. Well, hello. Yes, bin Laden's whereabouts have always been known. Why? Because Al-Qaeda is a CIA intelligence asset and has always been an intelligence asset and continues to be an intelligence asset. So there is no blowback. And I will argue that there's a blow forward. There's a blow forward. I will discuss that later, but when the blow forward has to do with the fact that the main ally of NATO in the war theater in Libya is Al-Qaeda. And there's absolutely no ambiguity with regard to that, because the CNN is actually acknowledging it. But they say they're not Al-Qaeda, they're former Al-Qaeda, and that now they're pro-democracy. Okay, but we'll discuss that a bit later. Shortly before 9/11, I was involved in researching the civil war in Macedonia. And in fact, I was in touch with the Prime Minister's office frequently by telephone and email, because what was happening is that a U.S. military mercenary company called MPRI, Military Professional Resources Incorporated, were advising both the Kosovo Liberation Army, which was integrated by Al-Qaeda units, Mujahideen, and they were also advising the Macedonian Defense Forces. And they were, in fact, coordinating the war on both sides. And what happened now, just barely 2 months before 9/11, it hasn't been much publicized. The Mujahideen were caught red-handed with U.S. military advisors. These are all former commanders of the U.S. military. They're senior commanders. And they were caught red-handed together in the same unit or guerrilla unit. And this led to a political scandal in Macedonia. The prime minister made statements and so on. So that barely a few months before 9/11, I knew that the intelligence asset was still working for the CIA and was still being used in covert operations. But then I also knew, and that's important, that Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations. Al-Qaeda is a very elusive concept. It includes quite a number of different organizations. But Al-Qaeda units were also being used in Bosnia in the early to mid-90s, integrating the Bosnian Muslim Army, and subsequently in the Kosovo Liberation Army, where Al-Qaeda was in fact involved, and they were also involved in training and so on, to the extent that even people from different parts of the Muslim world were buying real estate in Kosovo at the time. But what I want to signify by that is that throughout that whole period, the enemy number one, which allegedly committed these attacks, was in close liaison with their intelligence sponsors, the CIA, but also Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, which really operated as a go-between. Pakistan ISI was in touch with the terrorist organizations, the various organizations like Lashkar and Jaish in Pakistan, which were also involved in the training camps and so on. And that relationship has been maintained to this very day. The Pakistan Inter-Services Intelligence is virtually a subsidiary of the CIA, and it acts on behalf of the CIA. And I should mention another very important dimension is that in November 2001, and this was brought out in an article by Seymour Hersh, although he didn't really elaborate on the implications, is that Al-Qaeda combatants in Afghanistan were airlifted to northern Pakistan. They weren't sent to Guantanamo. Guantanamo was housed by civilians, people who were arrested left and right. The actual Al-Qaeda fighters were airlifted, and they were airlifted in military planes, and they were taken to northwest Pakistan, Waziristan, and that constitutes a new frontier, which today is the object of the drone attacks. So in other words, this is a very diabolical operation. You have to sustain these organizations as enemies of America, but also as assets. Now, an intelligence asset doesn't necessarily mean that these Islamic organizations know who their sponsors are. That's the whole point. An intelligence asset could be any one of us, okay? It's an instrument of U.S. intelligence, and it goes through different layers. In this case, Pakistan ISI was a very important relay in implementing U.S. intelligence operations. Now, I think from my standpoint, and I focused mainly on geopolitics, I've focused on some other aspects of 9/11 which have been covered in these hearings, but the geopolitics of 10 years of war. That was, in fact, the theme of our conference in Montreal. 9/11 has unleashed a roadmap of war and destruction. We are at the crossroads of the most serious crisis in modern history. I think that's not an understatement. And the war on terrorism is part of that process because it gives a justification to wage war on humanitarian grounds so that you wage the war not against countries, but against what they called non-state entities, which came, again, into the jargon. And that, I think, is very important. It provided, at each stage, Afghanistan, Iraq, of course, it was another pretext, but ultimately, the war on terrorism was also fought on the basis of the fact that there were terrorists with dirty bombs and so on. If we remember Colin Powell's presentation to the Security Council of the United Nations in February 2003, preceding the invasion of Iraq. And ultimately, the war on terrorism has been a continuum. And what has happened is that this war on terrorism has also been supported by media fabrications. I think that 9/11 is the onslaught, and that's why 9/11 truth is so important. 9/11 is the onslaught of war propaganda, and a higher level of war propaganda, and that actually happened immediately on the 12th of September. Immediately on the 12th of September, there were calls to invade Afghanistan from, what's his name, Sapphire, and various other pundits of the Washington Post and the New York Times, and said, yes, we must go after the terrorists. And all this has permeated the consciousness of millions of people. It's created an atmosphere of fear and intimidation, which was then coupled with the color-coded alerts and Homeland Security and so on. And it was a pretext to wage a war without borders, which in essence is a war of conquest. And it was also a pretext to implement far-reaching changes at home through the Patriot legislation, through national security, protection of borders. And you might even remember when you board the plane with your Johnny Walker black label. I should mention a word about the liquid bomb attacks, because they were totally fabricated, among many others. But the liquid bomb attacks, it turned out that the alleged terrorists did not have passports and did not have tickets to board the plane. Now, they must have screwed up somewhere, to say the least. But in any event, we went through a whole era of threats, of attacks on America. On the one hand, whereas in fact, what was happening was large-scale theater wars waged by America against countries around the world in various forms, either theater wars or covert operations or regime changes. And all of this was carried out under the banner of fighting the outside enemy, the elusive enemy, Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And as you know, first of all, we see al-Qaeda in Iraq. Then we see al-Qaeda in Yemen, al-Qaeda in Africa. We had subsidiaries of al-Qaeda virtually everywhere. And wherever the United States needed to intervene militarily, they used the pretext of al-Qaeda in Yemen or Somalia or wherever, under different names, and of course corroborated by media reports, etc. And in all cases, I can assure you, these are instruments of U.S. intelligence or MI6 or Mossad. And there's a collaboration between them. What I think is of concern to us is that the 9/11 big lie sets the stage for what I describe as the American Inquisition. The nature of an inquisitorial doctrine is very different to actual disinformation. There's a subtle difference, because media disinformation is that you hide the facts and you obfuscate certain things, and you lie. An inquisitorial doctrine is quite different. You don't necessarily need to lie. You don't obfuscate the torture camps in Guantanamo. In fact, you do exactly the opposite. You make them visible. Why? Because ultimately they are accepted as something which we can do. So torture then is accepted, because we need to go after the bad guys. So that an inquisitorial doctrine is based on, essentially, on enforcing the lie as the truth. Okay, it's not by obfuscating the truth and saying, no, well, this, that, and other. It's actually inverting the truth. It's transforming the lie into the truth. And then what happens is that this becomes a consensus. Responsibility to protect in Libya is a consensus. But in reality, what is it? It's the killing of thousands of people. And we've been following this war, and I can assure you the reports that are published. Our correspondent of global research, Mali Darius Nazarroya, who has reported back from Libya, and the atrocities committed by NATO have not been mentioned in any of the media. And responsibility to protect becomes the logo. It becomes something that we accept. And so an inquisitorial doctrine imposes itself as a consensus that you do not challenge, because it emanates from the highest authority of the land, not only from the head of state and the U.S. Congress, but from Ban Ki-moon, Secretary General of the United Nations, from the ICC, criminal courts, and so on. Everybody toes the line, and everybody is committed to going after bin Laden. Maybe I'm exaggerating. Let's say going after al-Qaeda. But again, it's the war on terrorism, and then it's supported by and financed by Islamophobia. And 9/11 is the ultimate, you know, it's like Adam bit the apple. So it's the starting point of this discourse and dogma which permeates every area of society. And it cannot be challenged. It can certainly be challenged in terms of factual information, but then people dismiss those facts because the Inquisition does not allow you to accept the truth. So what I'm saying here is that the lie becomes the truth, and the truth ultimately becomes a conspiracy to challenge that consensus. And there's a NATO consensus now in Libya, there's a NATO consensus in Syria, but what is not reported is the fact that the war on terrorism is waged not against the terrorists, but with the terrorists. So that I call that the GWAT WTT, okay? GWAT WTT means with the terrorists. GWAT with the terrorists signifies that in every single one of these military operations, the terrorists have been waging a guerrilla warfare on the ground, paramilitaries, often trained by special forces, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, certainly in Afghanistan. Well, in Afghanistan is a bit more complex, but in Iraq, as of 2004, when John Negroponte was sent as ambassador, his term was only for 1 year. His task was to put together the death squadrons based on the Salvador option, which he had applied in Central America in the 1980s. And these death squadrons were there as an instrument to obscure the role of the invader and weaken the resistance movement. Now, in Bosnia and Kosovo, we have documents which prove unequivocally that the United States, as an entity, was supportive of al-Qaeda. And we get it really from the horse's mouth, which is the Republican Party Committee of the U.S. Senate. And it's a document which was produced in 1997 and which accuses the Clinton administration. There was party politics involved in that. And they accuse Clinton of supporting al-Qaeda and working hand in glove with al-Qaeda and bringing in weapons into Bosnia. And so that is a document of the U.S. Senate. It's a public document. And we have other statements regarding the KLA. Now, we know that the KLA are listed by Interpol, and we know that the KLA is linked up with al-Qaeda and so on. We know that the KLA was supported by NATO. So that is well understood, waging the war on terrorism with the terrorists, not against the terrorists. And I contend that that concept is absolutely fundamental. It's not the blowback, it's the blow forward. Because the blowback tells you that al-Qaeda went against us, he's enemy number one. And the blow forward tells you that there's been a continuous relationship between entities of U.S. intelligence, Western intelligence generally, on the one hand, military as well, and entities linked up to the Islamic Jihad, what we now call as al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations. And the reason why all this is important, because the lie penetrates the inner consciousness of people. It changes their perceptions. It prevents people from thinking, even when they're confronted with the fact that al-Qaeda is in fact an instrument and not an object of the global war terrorism. And when the lie replaces the truth in people's inner consciousness, there's no going backwards. It's a very subtle mechanism. And the Spanish Inquisition understood perfectly well, but the French Inquisition was even worse. And it lasted for several hundred years, that your whole mindset is subordinated to something which is predetermined and fake, and you cannot reflect. Now, I'd like to blow forward, because it is a blow forward, and discuss very briefly two major areas of conflict today. One is Libya, and the other is Syria. Now, I can tell you unequivocally, and it's confirmed by media reports, that the main military units of the rebels in Libya are al-Qaeda. The military commander in Tripoli is al-Qaeda, or al-Qaeda affiliated. These are former commanders of the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, the LIFG. Now, the LIFG is a CIA creation. These commanders, these mujahideen, were trained in Afghanistan in CIA camps, the same procedure as those which fought in the Soviet-Afghan War, except in the subsequent period. And I can tell you that the LIFG is still on the list of the State Department. as a terrorist organization, and it's still on the United Nations Security Council list of terrorist organizations. And we know for a fact that the mainstay of these rebels are Al-Qaeda affiliated. There are other elements to the rebellion, which I won't go into. But the issue is the following. If you look at the press reports, they will acknowledge it. I think they have to acknowledge it because otherwise the truth might seep through. They acknowledge it and then they dismiss it. They say such and such is commander of the Tripoli rebel command. He's a former member of Al-Qaeda, but he is now pro-democracy. So what they do is they say these are former terrorists, former bad guys, and now they're good guys. So they're inverting the concepts. So you have a bad guy, and then CNN says, well, now they're committed to pro-democracy, etc., etc. They said the same thing in Kosovo with the KLA, that the KLA are criminals linked to the Italian mafia, but now we're going to use them to implement democracy. Now, essentially, this is what you have in Tripoli today. These rebels are committing major atrocities directed against the civilian population. But what we have to understand is that the war on terrorism is not only a fabrication, but the alleged enemy in this war on terrorism is in fact a partner in the war on terrorism. Namely, Al-Qaeda is used in military operations on the ground, interfacing with NATO special forces and so on and so forth. This, I think, for us is very important that we can refute, because ultimately, if the war on terrorism is no longer accepted and doesn't have its legitimacy, the whole construct of military doctrine collapses like a deck of cards. And that's why 9/11 truth is so important. The whole construct of global war on terrorism, it's not to say that they won't find other pretexts, but they won't be able to justify their war by lying to us. So when I say the global war on terrorism is a WTT, global war on terrorism with the terrorists, and it is not a blowback, but is a blow forward. And present-day wars in Libya are conducted by Al-Qaeda units on the ground. In Syria, we have a situation which is not quite the same, but what has happened is Salafist Muslim Brotherhood brigades have entered into Syria and are involved in terrorist acts directed against public buildings, acts of arson, killing of police and armed forces and civilians, which then has led to response by the security forces. Certainly the government of Bashar al-Assad bears a burden of responsibility in this, but we have to understand what triggered the crisis in Syria. And the crisis in Syria was triggered by Al-Qaeda-affiliated units infiltrating protest movements and shooting. And they're shooting on civilians, that's well documented, and they're shooting on people, they're even shooting on Christian communities, and this is consequently not a protest movement, it is an insurrection. The latest news that I have is that NATO is actually now, and this is confirmed by Israeli intelligence sources, that NATO is itself in the process of recruiting mujahideen, jihadist fighters, to wage their wars. They have a recruitment process, and it's an agreement between NATO and the Turkish military. Now, those reports remain to be verified, but it's well understood that that recruitment process has been going on for a long, long time. And those brigades are there precisely to perform a terrorist role, which is used to destabilize societies, create sectarian violence. Thank you very much.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Yes.
Passing and aftermath have once again brought to light Puerto Rico's primordial conundrum, colonialism. Together, they have left the island in shambles. Luis Rosa Perez and Rafael Bernabe, two of the island's most prominent social change agents, survey the damage on the ground wrought by the storms whose devastating path through the island was paved by Puerto Rico's status as a U.S. colony.
Luis and Rafael take stock of the island's needs, one people, one voice, against unjust laws that have been systematically oppressive and exploited the people and resources of Puerto Rico and prevented the socioeconomic growth and the sustainability of the island.
Luis Rosa Perez is a former U.S.-held Puerto Rican political prisoner of war. He served almost 20 years in U.S. prisons for fighting to free Puerto Rico from the colonial relationship it's had with the U.S. since 1898. In 1999, he and a group of Puerto Rican prisoners of war were given clemency by President Clinton. Luis Rosa Perez's commitment to his people have been described as sacrifice without hesitation.
And Professor Rafael Bernabe is a researcher and professor at the University of Puerto Rico. He's the author, with Cesar Ayala, of Puerto Rico, An American Century, A History Since 1898.
Glad to be with you.
And by the way, you should talk to each other. You know, Ken and I will be glad.
Well, if we start speaking in Spanish, then you won't understand us.
Oh, I don't know about that. Do you underestimate us?
Maybe, yes.
But I want to start with, it's more than a month now after Maria. Dozens of communities are still inaccessible by car or truck. Tell us, and let's begin with Luis first, who's in Aguadilla. What's happening on the ground? What are the issues of material need and deprivation that are faced by the people in Puerto Rico this whole month plus later? Luis?
We're still battling with the need for clean water, electricity on a consistent basis. A little less than 40% of the island has electricity. We have communication, it comes and goes as far as like the telephone services. The Puerto Rico telephone company that had underground or subterranean wires sustained was able to continue servicing after the hurricane, while others that bombarded the island and with communication towers were left in the dark, like AT&T and Verizon and all the other companies. There is some communication, there is some water being delivered to the houses with the pipelines, but not enough, and we don't really trust it. There's still major problems with the water source.
Rafael?
No, the situation is still, as Luis says, is still very bad. At least 60% of the people still lack electricity. That percentage is much higher in the interior of the island. In the mountainous interior of the island, you have many municipalities that basically have no electricity. I was recently speaking to somebody from Orocovis, which is a town near the center of Puerto Rico, and they say that basically nobody has electricity in that area. Evidently, the lack of electricity makes it very difficult to provide adequate medical and health services. Many of the hospitals are still running with generators that many times fail, and therefore the whole system of the hospital breaks down. I personally have a three-year-old son, which I had to take to the hospital recently. And while we were there, the electricity went off in the hospital. So you can imagine the situation in a hospital that has five or six floors full of people who are receiving services, and suddenly there's no electricity. In the same way, there are many people still don't have running water, and many people have difficult access to drinking water, particularly, as I said, in the interior of the island. The government reports in a rather untrustful way, I think, many of the situation in Puerto Rico. If you look at there's a map that you can see in the internet of the municipalities that already have electricity in Puerto Rico. One of the municipalities that they say has electricity is Trujillo Alto. I live in Trujillo Alto. I'm speaking to you from Trujillo Alto. There's no electricity in Trujillo Alto. So I don't know why they make such a statement or give such an image. So the situation is still very difficult, and as it's a situation that one would somehow expect to be the case a week after the storm, 2 weeks after the storm. But now here we are here, you know, 54, 55 days after the storm. So the response of the federal agencies, the emergency federal agencies in Puerto Rico, has been very slow and very inadequate in response to this very, very extreme situation that we have.
We've heard Donald Trump sneeringly talk about Puerto Rico as a dependent with extreme debt crisis before the hurricane, and that its electrical grid had been allowed to deteriorate before the hurricanes. Well, obviously that's true, but I want you to contextualize it and talk about the supposition that we raised to begin with, which is that the colonial status of Puerto Rico paved the way for some of the material devastation created by Irma and Maria. Luis?
Yeah, the crisis we're suffering now didn't come as a result of two hurricanes. It came as a result of over 100 years of colonialism, where the Jones Act prohibits us from using any other shipping lanes other than the U.S., which is three times higher than any other in the world. And most of the debt, it can be attributed to even that. It also has allowed for proxy governments who create projects that are spending a lot of money, spending a lot of these resources, and not coming about. For instance, the Gasoducto, some of the pipelines are still laying over there without laying in one of the municipalities without being used. But imagine if it was actually put together and with the cause of the hurricanes, all the destruction that would have caused. But there's been the main cause of what we're suffering now, the imposition of a quasi-government over a government with the junta, is evident of the colonial conditions that we live under.
And Rafael, could you expand on that with regard to the delivery of services and how that accents the need for a reconstruction plan for Puerto Rico?
Yes, absolutely. As Luis was saying, the situation, the storms in Puerto Rico, Irma and Maria, have aggravated the crisis that we were going through. They have not initiated that crisis. Before the storm, Puerto Rico was already suffering the consequences of a 10-year-long depression. The economy of Puerto Rico has not grown for 10 years now. We have been in a depressed, stagnant economy for 10 years. About 250,000 jobs have been lost in Puerto Rico during the last decade. That's about one-fifth. 20% of the jobs that existed in 2006 disappeared over the last 10 years. Imagine if the United States lost a fifth of its jobs during a decade. The whole of American society would be in a very deep crisis. Well, that is the situation in Puerto Rico, which also explains why many Puerto Ricans were already leaving the island at an accelerated pace over the last 5 or 6 years. Many were leaving the island because they don't have jobs. They cannot find any employment here. They have to go to the United States to see if they can make a living there. So the fact that the press has made much of the fact that there's a lot of Puerto Ricans leaving the island as a result of the storm. Well, the storm has accelerated that exodus, but it didn't initiate the exodus that was going on before. As Luis was saying, the economy of Puerto Rico has been stagnant. The irony of the situation of Puerto Rico is that while the economy doesn't grow, while the government doesn't have resources and therefore goes into debt, there are nevertheless corporations in Puerto Rico, U.S. corporations, that generate a tremendous amount of profit. The estimate of all economists is about $35 billion a year in profits that they generate in Puerto Rico, most of which pays no taxes or very little taxes, and most of which is not reinvested in Puerto Rico. So you have an economy which is very profitable to a very small group of corporations, but does not in any way satisfy the needs of the people. And the government, instead of trying to recuperate some of these profits that leave the island, has went into debt to a very large extent over the years, until the point that debt became simply unsustainable, unpayable. Our position has been over the years that that debt of Puerto Rico cannot be paid. The only way that it can be paid is by inflicting unacceptable human suffering on the people of Puerto Rico. Therefore, that debt, we argue for the longest time, has to be audited and has to be renegotiated. I believe that now, after the storm, after the impact of the storm in Puerto Rico, the catastrophic impact of the storm, that position has to change. Our position has to be that the debt of Puerto Rico has to be canceled. This debt cannot be collected. To collect a debt from a people who have suffered the devastation that the Puerto Rican people have suffered and the reconstruction that they will now have to undergo, to collect that debt now would be criminal, an act of inhumanity, which is quite unacceptable. So our first demand would be for the cancellation of the debt, given the new circumstances created by the storm. The second thing that we need is for the U.S. Congress to assume the responsibility that it has. Ironically, the U.S. Congress has insisted till now, you know, over 120 years, that Puerto Rico is a possession of the United States. Well, if it's a possession of the United States, Congress at least should take the responsibility of the situation that exists here. We think that Puerto Rico has the right to receive a significant amount of funds to reconstruct the island. I have always argued that this is in the interest of working people in the United States. The situation right now in Puerto Rico is that you have an economy from which U.S. corporations take out a lot of money, but poor people in Puerto Rico have no jobs. We have a very high unemployment rate in Puerto Rico, and therefore you have the federal funds that have to be spent in Puerto Rico to kind of subsidize this dysfunctional economy for the benefit of U.S. corporations. It's in the interest of the Puerto Rican people and in the interest of U.S. working people that Puerto Rico gets an economy that functions, that can generate employment and income for its people, and therefore requires no subsidy. So I think the situation generated by this hurricane should be an opportunity to reconstruct our economy in a way that it works for the people of Puerto Rico, in a way that it's not a burden for the working people of the United States. And I think we should work together in that direction.
You know, one of the things that Luis Rafael was saying is clearly the dependent and colonial nature of Puerto Rico's economy lies at the root of the mm-hmm. high levels of unemployment. I'm going back and remembering, from the 80s. Do you remember the 2020 plan? We talked about that a bit. And I have this apprehension, as happened, for example, in New Orleans, that reconstruction and rebuilding is not rebuilding for the people indigenous to the area. That if anything, it facilitates a kind of gentrification and the ushering in the case of Puerto Rico, the likelihood of it becoming again or more so a playground community for the U.S. mainland elite. And I'm wondering to what extent you have those kind of concerns and to what extent those multinational plans, the massive mining operations and so on from things like the 2020 project, are this becomes an advantage for them to surge ahead, particularly since the island is virtually under the control of PROMESA, the Puerto Rican Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act. What do you think? Let's start with Luis and Rafael, by all means.
I was always under the impression that the 2020 plan was not shelved. It was just continuing in a slower pace than they wanted it at the beginning. But if you look at the construction of the expressway, the number 10, through Utuado and up to Ajuntas, where they discovered copper mines. If you look at the water pipeline to serve the industrial parks. And now when you look at the depopulation of the island and the gentrification of the major cities in the island, you see the 2020 plan coming back to life. And you've had even some senators in Puerto Rico from the PNP government who have alluded to the possible strip mining as a source of revenue where it can pay some of this debt. So I never thought it was dead, the 2020 plan. And I think now under these conditions, it is something that we need to revisit, something that we need to rethink and work against. Because if you look at, like you mentioned, the construction that's happening now in areas like Rincón and San Juan and Vieques, Culebra, and some of these towns are not apartments for Puerto Ricans. They're condos for the elite. They're condos for immigration of North Americans and even Europeans coming into the island and basically serving the finance capital and not really for us. We've been given, and we're being given it on a daily basis, tickets to, out of here to Orlando and to Chicago and to Texas. And we're being recruited as teachers, the bilingual teachers in Texas and other states. So, yeah, there is a depopulation happening. There's a displacement also. And we're slowly seeing a gentrification happening in this country, like, you know, like it's happening in Chicago and New York and elsewhere.
Rafael?
As you mentioned, the situation in New Orleans after Katrina, very similar to the one we are experiencing in Puerto Rico right now. I personally think that they don't even need a plan. They are operating in the search of very short-term profits, and they are taking advantage of the situation generated by the storm to carry out plans or objectives that they had before the storm. Whether they are part of a plan or not, it's hard to know, but they are doing it. I'll give you an example. They are trying to take advantage of the present situation to push forward the privatization of the electrical system. This is something that they have wanted to do for the longest time. And now that the electrical system has collapsed, that people are desperate to have electricity turned back on and so on, they want to use this emergency to say, okay, we have to rebuild the electrical system. We don't have money to do that. Congress is not going to give us money to do that, so we have to go to the private model, the private investors. In the same fashion, most of the schools in Puerto Rico are still closed. The whole educational system is paralyzed. And as you know, in New Orleans, the similar situation was used in order to push the model of charter schools and to privatize or semi-privatize the schools. One sees that probably they're going to try to push that type of program given the present crisis that we are living in Puerto Rico. In the same fashion, the economic crisis which we have been undergoing is going to become deeper now, at least in the short term. I read that there are at least 10 or 12 hotels which have closed or partially closed. That is thousands of workers that are going to be out of work or are already out of work. And most of these workers, many of these workers, are going to have to migrate. They're going to have to try and find jobs somewhere else because they are not going to find jobs in Puerto Rico. So all of these situations which existed before the storm, or all of these plans which were already formulated before the storm, are now being accelerated or being put forth as solutions to the crisis. And needless to say, one of the difficulties we have right now is that under normal conditions, you would have people mobilizing, you would have people organizing, you would have people protesting, marching or carrying out pickets, all sorts of activities to protest some of these programs and plans. But right now, most people are basically trying to survive and trying to, you know, make sure they have water for tomorrow or to solve some very immediate problems. So it really makes it much more difficult for us to mobilize. And that's one of the reasons why the job and the work that you people do from the United States, keeping an eye on what's happening in Puerto Rico and denouncing the situation in Puerto Rico, is very important, because during these weeks, many times people from outside Puerto Rico concerned about Puerto Rico were far more able to speak up or speak out about Puerto Rico than we who are here were able to, because right now we have phone service. I'm speaking with you over my phone, but a week and a half ago, it was very hard for me to get connection here from my home, from where I'm speaking right now.
Luis, do you know of any instances of effective mobilizing in Puerto Rico now, despite the difficulties?
Excuse me.
The issue of people organizing, because that is maybe the flip side. So the kind of mobilization, the kind of organizing that people are doing, and what opportunities does that also represent to organize around the issue of the colonial status of Puerto Rico? Or is that a little further in abeyance given the crisis?
Right now, what we're trying to do in Rafael was saying is true, that there's not many demonstrations out there, massive demonstrations, but what there is brigades of people helping other people, building community. And right now, the colonial question perhaps is not as fluid right now in the discussion. It's not the narrative so much. Right now, we're trying to build a roof for someone to have shelter. We're trying to bring clean water, for someone to have drinking water, you know, and that's what where the concentration is. But at the same time, we're setting an example. We're building community. We're engaging people. We're letting them know that this is not the government. The government has been inept in meeting some of the concerns. These are people with the help from Puerto Ricans and the diaspora, with the help from people in solidarity, that is providing this for these communities. That is our concern right now, to basically help those who need shelter, build the roofs, and engage them into helping others as well in the community. And perhaps with that example, we raise their spirits, and they can see that they don't really need to depend on the government. They can, some of these things, that some of these essential needs that they can fulfill with building a community, with finding other alternatives.
Rafael, how does this get turned into a mobilization against the domination of the economic interests of the island by the junta? How does that kind of activity that Luis was talking about now get parlayed into a movement, and a movement to demand the reconstruction of Puerto Rico? But what kind of reconstruction are we talking about, or do we want?
I think, you know, there are going to be several stages that we will have to go through. As Luis was saying, we are still in the stage of trying to tend to very immediate, very urgent needs. People basically cannot go to a demonstration or go to... I'll give you a perfect example. When President Trump came to Puerto Rico, in normal times, there would have been, I am sure, a very big demonstration against Donald Trump and everything that he stands for, his racist, xenophobic, reactionary, anti-Latino positions, as you well know. There would have been a huge demonstration against Trump in Puerto Rico. But given the time that he came, nobody was able to do anything. We didn't have gasoline at that moment. We didn't have electricity. No, we didn't have water. We didn't have anything. So it was very frustrating to have President Trump come to Puerto Rico and not being able to express our feelings towards the policies of his administration, but that was the situation. Now, that will end. You know, I am sure that we will be able to progressively normalize the material situation in Puerto Rico, relatively speaking. And at that point, I think there are going to be important struggles regarding the policies that the government is going to try to implement. If they try to go through with the privatization of the closing of more schools, that's going to be a struggle. If they try to privatize the electrical system, that's going to be a struggle. Mm-hmm. If they try to remove certain communities in the name of reconstructing them but really gentrifying them, that is going to be a struggle. So all of these things are going to come up as the situation gets normalized. Beyond that, I think we have to try and generate a public debate in Puerto Rico about issues as the ones that I mentioned. I think there's a good ground for that. The notion that Puerto Rico cannot pay the debt, the $70 billion debt that the government of Puerto Rico has, cannot be paid, has to be canceled. I think that notion that many people perhaps were very doubtful about in the past, that demand, I think, will have more support now because people will understand that. We don't have houses. We don't have an electrical system. We have to reconstruct the roads. We have to reconstruct the health services. We have to house and feed a lot of people who have lost everything. How are we supposed to pay $70 billion of this debt? This is not possible. This is not acceptable. That demand has to be raised. I think it will... If we do it well, I think a lot of people are going to mobilize behind that demand. And in the same fashion, positive situation is going to be generated in terms of discussing what are we going to do with the colonial situation of Puerto Rico. If anything, I think that this present crisis has led many people to begin to see the reality of that colonial situation. Many people in Puerto Rico, unfortunately, but that's the truth, thought that once the storm hit, that the federal government was going to be here with billions of dollars to immediately reconstruct Puerto Rico, and they have realized that this is not the case. This is not going to happen, that we have to rely on ourselves. We have to reconstruct Puerto Rico ourselves. We have to rethink how we relate to the United States and how we relate to the world, and that is going to be an interesting debate. I don't know what the conclusion of the debate is going to be. But for those of us who are for self-determination, those of us who are for independence, those of us who want profound social change in Puerto Rico, there's going to be a space, an important space, to bring up all these questions. Because now, really, Puerto Rico has to reconsider itself, reinvent itself after this disaster.
And Luis,
that is a healthy debate.
Luis Rosa Perez, we're going to give you the last word. Off of what Rafael Bernabe was saying, what kind of reconstruction do we want? How would it look different? What's on the agenda for Puerto Rico that we here on the mainland must support?
There was no normality before the storm, and we can't return back to what it was. We have to contemplate something different. Like Rafael was saying, we have to make ourselves heard in this discussion of the status. Puerto Rican independence right now becomes a necessity for survival. And I believe that the Puerto Ricans in the diaspora, the communities throughout Chicago, New York, and wherever Puerto Ricans are going to have to play a major role in this as well. There are over 5 million Puerto Ricans now living in the United States, and the island is quickly being depopulated by Puerto Ricans. So we need to re-engage. We need to rethink of what strategies we can implement to re-educate people to present independence out of that that intangible, make people believe that they can govern themselves, and we have the resources to govern ourselves. And I want to thank everyone from Chicago, from New York, from Cleveland, from everywhere who has helped in the recovery. Now we have to help in the reconstruction.
With all the demands and all the issues that Rafael Bernabe and Luis Rosa Perez have raised, brothers, thank you for spending some time with us. Stay safe, and we will make it so. And on the front burner, the issue of the status, the independence of Puerto Rico, and, of course, the material rebuilding in an ecologically sound way determined by the people and not the corporate vultures. We want to thank you so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
For the last 6 years, I've had the privilege of leading the first Australians in the annual Mardi Gras parade, which is something I never thought in my wildest dreams would happen, but it did. I love being Aboriginal, born with my culture, but growing up in a racist society like Australia, you know, that's bad enough, and then you've got to deal with the fact you're gay. And then you're a drag queen on top of that. You're a trifecta.
Welcome
welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Lucia Chappelle. Trans candidates top historic U.S. election outcomes.
Germany's high court demands an intersex option.
And a fateful meeting with destiny has arrived.
Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned into This Way Out.
I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending November 11, 2017. In what the U.S. Democratic National Committee called a landmark moment in LGBTQ history, a record number of queer candidates won decisive victories in local elections across the country on November 7th. Perhaps most notably, transgender office seekers were victorious in Virginia, Minnesota, Georgia, California, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut.
In Virginia, Danica Rome unseated 26-year incumbent Bob Marshall by nearly 10 points. Rome has become the first openly transgender person to win election to the state legislature. Her victory is particularly sweet because her opponent spent his entire career as an elected official pushing anti-LGBT legislation, including a failed bathroom bill.
Andrea Jenkins won a seat on the city council in Minneapolis, Minnesota, making her the first black transgender woman to win an elected office in the United States. Philippe Cunningham also narrowly unseated City Council President Barbara Johnson, becoming the first black transgender man to be elected to office in the United States.
In Georgia, Steffi Kuntz, a transgender woman and small business owner, won a seat on the Doraville City Council. That made her the only openly transgender person to hold elected office in the state. And in California, Lisa Middleton won a historic victory to the Palm Springs City Council. She's the first openly transgender person to win a non-judicial elected office in the state. Her election also means that the entire Palm Springs City Council will be under queer control, with two gay men, Jeff Kors and J.R. Roberts, who are not up for re-election, the aforementioned transgender Lisa Middleton, and also newly elected bisexual woman Christy Holstage.
Tyler Titus became the first out transgender person elected to office in the state of Pennsylvania. The 33-year-old father of two grabbed one of the four open seats on the Erie School Board. And Raven Mathern joins the Stamford Board of Representatives, becoming Connecticut's first out transgender lawmaker and the youngest ever board member to boot.
Virginia not only elected its first transgender member to the House of Delegates in Danica Rome, but its first lesbian lawmaker, Don Adams. The nurse practitioner and healthcare advocate was elected in a district that includes the city of Richmond. In Ohio, Tamaya Denard, an African-American lesbian, was elected to the Cincinnati City Council. She'll join Chris Seelbach, a gay man who was reelected.
In Seattle, Washington, Jenny Durkin won 61% of the vote to become the first out lesbian mayor in that city's history.
Literally dozens of other out candidates, almost all of them Democrats, were elected in towns and cities across the United States. Several were running for office for the first time, having been activated by the Electoral College victory 1 year ago this week of Donald J. Trump.
Elsewhere, Germany's Constitutional Court has made the country the first in Europe to offer intersex people a third gender option if they don't identify as either male or female. The justices said that strictly binary gender options violate the right to privacy. They gave lawmakers until the end of 2018 to either allow a third gender category on public documents or eliminate gender designations altogether. The decision, which overturned a lower court ruling, comes in the case of a German citizen born in 1989 who was identified only as Vanja by Third Option, an advocacy group that supported the plaintiff. Morris Schmidt, a spokesman for Third Option, said he hoped the victory in the country's highest court will be used to fight against discrimination wherever inter- and transgender people still suffer disadvantages due to their gender. Australia, Bangladesh, India, Malta, Nepal, New Zealand, and Pakistan recognize more than two genders on passports or national ID cards. Thailand recognizes a third gender in its constitution, but has yet to make that an option on government documents. Canada began issuing passports with a third gender option X in August. Not everyone accepts such a gender designation, however, and using such a document in a queer oppressive country could be downright dangerous.
Nicola Sturgeon, Scotland's First Minister, apologized this week for historic laws that criminalize consensual sex between male adults. It was illegal in the country for men 21 years of age or older to have sex with each other until 1981. The age of consent was only equalized at 16 in 2001. Today, as First Minister, Sturgeon said, "I categorically, unequivocally, and wholeheartedly apologize for those laws and for the hurt and the harm that they caused to so many." Sturgeon's apology coincided with the introduction of a bill that will symbolically pardon all gay and bisexual men, living and dead, who are convicted under those laws. However, a conviction remains on a man's record and will appear on background checks until he submits an application to Scottish ministers to have it disregarded or removed, and after evaluating available evidence in each specific case, they approve. "Nothing that this Parliament does can erase those injustices," Sturgeon added. "But I do hope this apology, alongside our new legislation, can provide some comfort to those who endured those injustices."
The state of Western Australia said sorry last week. Premier Mark McGowan delivered the apology in Parliament on November 1st as he introduced a bill to expunge the criminal records of men convicted of private consensual adult gay sex, which was illegal in the state until 1990. "Today is about doing what we can to right the wrongs of the past," he said. "On behalf of the government of Western Australia, I'm sorry for the hurt, for the prejudice, for the discrimination that ruined lives. Men who want to have their criminal record expunged must apply to the Western Australian government. Relatives of those who have passed away can also apply to have their convictions removed." The formal apology by the Western Australian government follows similar moves in several other states.
Voting in Australia's National Marriage Equality Postal Plebiscite closed on November 7th. The Australian Bureau of Statistics, which is in charge of tabulating the results, announced that more than 12.5 million people participated in the non-binding, non-compulsory survey. That amounts to an extraordinary 78.5% of eligible voters, and that percentage could go even higher after last-minute votes are counted.
A predicted victory for the yes forces would certainly have come at a cost, however. The advocacy group LGBTI Legal Service has been running a project called Like Love in an effort to track what it calls unlawful vilification. The group, which is based in Queensland, counted literally hundreds of examples of hate speech on the social media and news websites it monitored, and in public spaces where, in just one example, flyers distributed by neo-Nazi groups warned voters to stop the fags. Matilda Alexander, the group's president, said that throughout the campaign, "It has been virtually impossible for anyone who identifies as queer to avoid exposure to views which condemn who they are as a person."
Meanwhile, Conservative MPs are already developing plans to at least stall the inevitable if the yes forces prevail, as expected, when the results are officially announced on November 15th. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has promised that a marriage equality bill would then be introduced and passed in Parliament soon thereafter. Opponents claim to be worried about threats to religious freedom, even though proposed marriage equality legislation specifically protects those freedoms and makes it clear that clergy will not be required to officiate at the weddings of same-gender couples. Wheeling and dealing behind closed doors among MPs across the political spectrum is reportedly underway.
And finally,
I'm staying.
We told you last week that the government of Kenya banned the Disney Channel's tween show, Andy Mack, after one of its young characters began coming out in the season 2 premiere. That ban was announced with great bluster, despite the fact that the show's Disney distributor in Kenya said it never planned to offer Andy Mack to viewers in that country. But this week, DSTV, which distributes Disney Channel programs in South Africa, announced that Andy Mack would not be seen in that country either. Disney Channel in South Africa serves multiple countries across Africa and the Middle East, each with its own regulations to which we adhere, a statement explained. Accordingly, Andy Mack will not be broadcast through DSTV. That means that the show won't be seen in as many as 50 countries across sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East. However, the DSTV statement concluded, "We are exploring alternative ways to make the series available to its fans in South Africa." Disney Channel representatives reportedly spoke to a number of child development experts and LGBT groups to ensure that the coming out story arc is age-appropriate and respectful. The U.S. media advocacy group GLAAD was one of them, according to its president, Sarah Kate Ellis, who lamented this week's announcement. "Television reflects the real-life world," she said. "Today, that includes LGBTQ youth who deserve to see their lives depicted on their favorite shows." I'm ready for tomorrow. Tomorrow starts today. There ain't no map to follow, but I'm with you all the way. All the way.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending November 11th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Extra, read all about it.
For recent programming information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, Noah in the Noah's Ark movie and TV series, and you've discovered This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
My people, Aboriginal people. Don't forget what we're fighting for. We are the original people of the land. Custodians.
Australia's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples have lived on the continent down under for more than 50,000 years, making them the world's oldest living cultures. As with Native North Americans, an Australian Aboriginal will likely identify first with their nation or clan rather than the label Indigenous or Aboriginal. Today, over 250 distinct language groups exist across Australia, roughly corresponding to a clan or identity as a First Nation group.
Each Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people traditionally had its own cultural attitudes towards homosexuality. Some are more accepting than others. Then, layered on top of that, are the colonial attitudes brought with the British, mostly with the churches, which again brought another set of cultural values. For many years, official state policy in Australia was to try to eradicate or assimilate Aboriginal people's culture into Australia's mainstream. There were stolen generations of children taken from their parents to be raised as so-called white fellas, a policy that has caused much harm to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australia. Many were left feeling rootless or removed from the long association their wider family group has had with the culture of their ancestors.
Since colonization, many Aboriginal and Torres Strait people have gravitated toward Australia's towns and cities. Some have left their traditional country and communities, the connections so very important to their cultural identity. In the 2016 census, 3% of people identified as Aboriginal. Sydney has quite a large Aboriginal population, a mixture of different peoples from different Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander ethnic backgrounds. Many who choose to live in Sydney identify with or come from an Aboriginal community from within the state of New South Wales, where Sydney is the capital.
Racism against Aboriginal people has been prevalent in Australia since early colonization. Racism persists today, although efforts are being made to promote Indigenous Australians' pride in their culture and heritage, as well as to educate the wider population on the diversity, strength, and resilience of Australia's original inhabitants. This Way Out correspondent Barry McKay will be chatting with some first Australians who identify as LGBTIQ in a series of reports that starts in the Sydney drag scene.
Aboriginal drag queens are talented, fabulous and stunning and just as good as any of the performers international listeners may be acquainted with from the film Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. But go to any of the mainstream gay clubs in Sydney's famous Oxford Street and you won't find very many Aboriginal drag queens performing there. Racism, it would seem, is still prevalent in the LGBTIQ community in Australia. In many cases, the Aboriginal LGBTIQ community holds its own social events where such performers get a chance to strut their stuff. One prominent star is Destiny Has Arrived, aka Colin McDonald, a young Bundjalung man from the northern New South Wales town of Lismore. In 2015, Destiny was the official face of the lesbian and gay Mardi Gras in Sydney in her own unique and innovative brand of Australian drag. I caught up with her in February this year, just before the LGBTIQ Aboriginal community in Sydney celebrated the Koori Gras as part of this year's Mardi Gras celebrations. Koori, for those who don't know, is a word used in Australian English for an Aboriginal person from Southeast Australia. I asked Destiny Has Arrived about her involvement in the LGBTIQ Aboriginal community.
At the moment, I am the face and ambassador for a national Indigenous HIV awareness campaign for an organisation, Nukuna Asma, which is the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander HIV Alliance in Australia. So that's part of something I do, which is travelling, going to events. And I use the image of Wonder Woman, which I've now turned into the Aboriginal Wonder Woman.
Can you describe the costume to the listeners?
I've just taken from her and added my own little dashes of my culture, such as the lasso. I now have a gold boomerang. The cape is an Aboriginal flag. It's an amazing outfit. It was made and designed by a famous drag queen friend of mine, Maud Boat, a.k.a. Michael Gates. Yeah, amazing collaboration there. I also, for the last 6 years, have had the privilege of leading the First Australians in the annual Mardi Gras parade, which is something I never thought in my wildest dreams would happen, but it did. I think just being visible and performing and my social networking, being present.
How do you make drag and Indigenous culture go hand in hand?
I think it's just self-expression. Art, like, you know, drag is art. And that's what I do. I'm inspired by all sorts of different people and my culture, and to bring that together and create something with my own stamp on it. So it's not where you take from, it's where you take it to, and the intention.
What aspects of Indigenous culture do you draw upon in your inspiration?
Back home, like, I'm from a Bundjalung country, which is Lismore, northern New South Wales. My family's art, my elders, who are now since passed on, but, you know, all helped to raise me, their stories, events in the world, like, everything. Like, yeah.
Could you tell me a bit about your own personal coming out story, coming to Sydney, leaving Lismore? How did your parents react when you came out to them?
Oh, look, I came out back up in Lismore in 99. I never really had a problem with my family because they pretty much knew, because I was raised as a child to have, I had boys' toys, I had girls' toys. I had to be myself. And those that didn't agree with it were just told by my mother and others to leave me alone and let me be who I am. And so that wasn't a problem. And then my mother also didn't have a problem at all. She encouraged me to be who I am and loved me for who I was. But also she disappeared 3 years later and is still a missing person today. And I tried to use that negative as a positive. So I came to Sydney to NAISDA, which is Indigenous College of Dance, to do some dance training. So I love dancing, always have. Love Madonna, the whole inspiration thing. And then, yeah, took some time out, dealt with that situation. And then Destiny arrived, my alter ego.
Come
got my name from the Olivia Newton-John song called Magic. If we hope survive, destiny will arrive. And so, yeah, that was my dream, and I think that is magic, just to be who you are and what you want to do. And
what does destiny arrive do on stage?
She always tells a story in my performances. If you get it, the audience gets it. They do. If they don't, well, that's fine. I just keep coming back and saying it again. Just beauty, magic in life, love.
What sort of stories do you tell on stage?
A lot of it's about self-acceptance, who I am, who you are, like, be yourself. Love, respect, to have fun, and having fun.
How did you find fitting into Sydney when you came from a small country town to a big city?
There was a bit of a culture shock. I had been to Sydney previously for 2002 Mardi Gras Parade. Yeah, it was mind-blowing, and I'm still dealing with it, yeah.
Did you miss, I mean, you lost connection to family, to your wider kinship network. Did you find that coming here to Sydney, you found yourself rootless in that time?
Well, at first, yes, I didn't know anyone, but over time I've developed my own little family here in Sydney and do have family here. We have an amazing set of friends. But yeah, I don't really get into the scene. It's not really where I want to be, what I want to do. I'm political, I guess. And yeah, we can all, you know, get up there and just maybe our ego and what have you, but yeah.
When you say you're political, what causes...
About racism, acceptance, being different. Like, you know, I know it's harsh, but the gay community, it goes on about equality and accepting, wanting acceptance, but in the subcultures within it, the gay community is like hypocritical.
Can you give me some examples?
Labels? Like, what I saw when I first appeared on the scene was, oh, you're Aboriginal, so put you in that box. But I just kept positive and kept doing what I wanted to do, and amazing things happened. And I've also met some inspirational people, peers along the way as well.
Have you found a support network here in Sydney with the...
Yes.
LGBT Indigenous community?
Absolutely. Now I have, absolutely. Yep. But I am aware culturally too that this is my country, I'm not from here. So I just do what I can, and inspiring other people. There's a trio at the moment, a warrior trio, the Dreamtime Deepers, who say I inspire them to do what they're doing as well, and that's beautiful because that's what I set out to do. Because I got on the scene, where all the Aboriginal drag queens, and didn't see any except for Dory Manganini, who's like a legend. So yeah, and that inspired me to get out and do it. Be visible, inspire others. We're just as good.
Can you speak any more about racism in the wider LGBT community and what you think can be done to help some of its members be more accepting of their Indigenous LGBT brothers and sisters?
Oh, look, I think it just comes down to respect. But you don't like to like someone or who they are, but you still respect them for who they are and leave it at that. Just watch words, because words can be harsh. When I appeared on the scene, I was still going through my mother's disappearance and depression and all that. And I just wasn't prepared for the bitchy, nasty world of drag in that sense. Drag, I thought, was fun. I thought there'd be a sisterhood. There is a sisterhood, but I had to find my own.
When you say there was a bitchy, nasty culture, are you meaning from white drag queens?
Yes. Yeah. But see, to them, it's a joke. You know, and well, that's some of the things I've heard. It's supposed to be fun. It's like, yeah, but sometimes you don't know what someone's going through in their personal life. You could be cutting them, but you don't know that because it's about your ego. And that's fine, but I choose to stay away from that. I'm here to inspire people and make them smile.
They say that when a man puts on drag, a new person comes out, a new alter ego comes out.
Yeah, well, see, that's what Destiny is to me, because this is what I was going through personally. She was my protection. No one knew who I was, and I liked it that way. Yeah, but she's protected me, and we're now uncomfortable. I'm healed, and now I know where I'm going, what I want to do now more. And I've done some amazing things, like leading and being the face of 2015 Mardi Gras, something I never thought in my wildest dreams. And that's what I show our young people. I just had an idea. go with it. Never know what may happen.
What has healed you?
Family and my own self-acceptance. I have nothing to prove to anybody.
Is self-acceptance difficult for an Indigenous person who is LGBT, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Especially in Australia, well, in this country, not only Aboriginal. Like, that's, I love being Aboriginal, born with my culture, but growing up in a racist society like Australia, you know, that's bad enough, and then you've got to deal with the fact you're gay. And then you're a drag queen on top of that. You're a trifecta. I'm inspired by trailblazers in history, and that's what I intend to keep doing.
What's the way forward for Aboriginal Australia and white Australia for reconciliation, do you think?
Well, number one is just respect. Aboriginal is just, it's a spiritual thing, it's a feeling, it's our history. It's still so young, like we didn't have rights in this country as citizens to vote until the late 1967, which really isn't that long ago. Listening to my family experiences in the 60s, 70s, wow, glad I didn't grow up then. The younger generation now, we are so much luckier, but I believe in my own heart that if we keep looking backwards, we can't go forwards. But there has to be, from non-Indigenous Australia, an understanding and empathy for Aboriginal people. And it's history and it's the truth. It's all about respect.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Let's create equality for all.
If you'd like to see video of Destiny Has Arrived performing at this year's Coup Rigras, just head to thiswayout.org. With thanks to the Bumali Gallery Leichhardt and to Mughalan Arts in Sydney, I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia, for This Way Out.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the non-profit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Carol Myers and Wenzel Jones, produced by Steve Pride, and from Barry Mackay. Chris Phillips performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music.
This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Prentham, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. For everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Lucia Chappell. We all thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CKUW Winnipeg, Manitoba,
Contact FM Hamilton, New Zealand,
Gay SA Radio Pretoria, South Africa,
and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station.
Now y'all stay tuned.
Thank you. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Some people in this country are less healthy than others, and much of that has to do not with genetics, but with environmental factors, with where and how people live and how they are regarded and treated by healthcare professionals. Race and racism play a role in that, in how likely people are to live in poverty or to live in areas with high pollution levels or to be given lower quality healthcare. As Catherine Bliss has pointed out, genetic science has been increasingly influenced by calls to address racial disparities and inequality. And so one might hope that scientists in that field have begun investigating the social and structural factors that generate health disparities along racial lines. Catherine Bliss has been investigating this issue for some time. She is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of California, San Francisco, and the author of Race Decoded, The Genomic Fight for Social Justice. She also, and this will be our focus today, contributed a chapter about genetics and health disparities to the new volume Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. In that chapter, Bliss writes that notions of race and health disparities have been increasingly biologized, and redress for social inequality has been re-envisioned in the form of pills and diagnostics. When Catherine Bliss joined me recently in studio, I asked her when the U.S. government took on, as she has written, the conviction that it was morally indebted to racial minorities for all those years and decades of neglect.
This change really started happening in the 80s. You see, in 1980, the Surgeon General's report starts to focus on racial minorities and health disparities. And by 1986, so, you know, further along into the 80s, you actually have the term health disparities being used by the government and increasingly by public health officials. And from 86 into the early 90s, it became a real focus of biomedicine as well, but especially of public health. So it starts with the Surgeon General's report, and then it starts to move into the public health department as a whole, and then it becomes the focus of public health efforts in biomedical research. So the change mostly happened in the 80s and then really took on new life in biomedicine in the 1990s, especially the early 90s.
And when you say health disparities, what are we talking about?
Initially, health disparities referred to just a kind of vague sense of differences in the ways that Blacks and whites were treated, and the kind of health care they were getting, and also the different disease rates. So it was a little bit more vague in the beginning. And later on, as health disparities research became a thing, and it was really something that was taken up by social epidemiologists and medical sociologists and medical, social scientists who study medicine, then you start to see a lot more of the specificities of, what aspects of healthcare delivery are responsible for disparities. So not just something like, there are differences in cancer rates between Blacks and whites, but now you get to, especially towards the early 90s, when it became a big part of the public health initiative to do something about health disparities, and they start using the language of eradicate health disparities in policy, in fact, and in grant mechanisms. So kind of money being offered to researchers to do new research on new topics. So around then, you start to see this kind of shift towards specificities of what kind of care is not being given, or what kind of treatment is being given differentially. And so that's the kind of shift that you see from the 80s to the 90s.
So, for example, healthcare providers, depending on the race of their patient, they may act differently. They may treat this person differently.
Correct, yes. And give different drugs and give different, therapies, allocate medication differently. For example, one current disparity is in pain medication, the prescription of pain medication. And again, I keep on going back and forth about Blacks and whites, but that was how the focus was initially and has continued to be. But now we have a lot more research that looks across all racial groups. And health disparities, there is a great deal of research that focuses on male-female health disparities, but a lot of the focus is on racial health disparities, in the sense that many times when people notice the difference between male and female disease rates or care differentials, there's a certain naturalized kind of view that this is because males and females are sexually different. And so when we use the term health disparities, most of the time it's focusing on racial health disparities.
Many people have heard about the Human Genome Project, which was launched in 1986. To what extent were scientists with this project, at least initially, interested in or focused on health disparities and racial disparities?
In the beginning, the Human Genome Project was not focused on racial health disparities or really interested in studying anything that had to do with racial differences. And the project launched in 1986, so it was kind of coming about at the same time as health disparities research was coming about. And initially, the project was kind of a basic science look at the genome, and leaders didn't make as many promises about the public health benefits of genomics. It was more like curiosity about what the genome was.
Right. It's about sequencing the genome, mapping the genome.
Exactly. Yes. And so what they did was the project really just collected DNA from any sources that it could collect DNA from, and it looked for the most robust sources of DNA within what they had collected. And they used the technology of the time to just stitch together a genome from many different sources. And so where, you know, what type of human that came from was not of interest in the beginning. It was just whatever they could do to create the human genome, a complete genome.
And that, to me, suggests that the assumption was that different populations are kind of interchangeable, are equal in certain ways.
Correct, yes. The human genome mappers, these scientists who were leading the project, they really had this belief that everybody was essentially the same, that we were so similar, in fact, to our primate cousins, you know, that you could take any human on Earth and you could create a genome from their genome and it would be representative of what we were looking for, which is what is a human, you know, what is a human like? What is a genome? But what happened is, you know, of course, the project started in 1986, but the project didn't end until 2003, in fact. And it really started to wrap up in the year 2000. So what you have is the beginning of the project, you know, being pretty much not interested in anything to do with race. And then as the public health initiative around health disparities grew within all of, you know, these different biomedical institutions, and this is something that I focus on so closely in terms of the U.S., but you can see this happening in the other governments that were involved in the Human Genome Project, because it wasn't just a United States project, right? Although it was based mostly in the U.S., but, you know, DNA was taken from all over the world, and it was a partnership of many, many governments. So you can see the same kind of thing of this increasing interest in health disparities. And then you see the project itself starting to take on the language of health disparities and also of race specifically. So in the mid-90s, in 1993, in fact, there was this really monumental shift in policy. NIH, which is the National Institutes of Health, the main, you know, research funder and research entity of the United States that looks at public health and health research, the NIH created a policy around using a specific set of racial categories in order to do good research, good science. And so from then on, you see the Genome Project, the Human Genome Project, and the other genome projects that started to crop up around that time, starting to use the same kind of emphasis on using racial categories, thinking about sampling by race and making sure that all of the different racial groups are included and represented. And then what happens from there is an actual focus on separate racial groups within each project.
Catherine Bliss is her name. She is an associate professor of sociology at the University of California, San Francisco. She's author of the book Race Decoded, The Genomic Fight for Social Justice. And we are talking about some of the research in that book, as well as what she has conveyed in a chapter she contributed to the volume Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. Her chapter is called The Meaning of Health Disparities. My name is C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, speaking of looking kind of at the diversity and the racial diversity of genomes and genetic makeups, the Human Genome Diversity Project was launched in 1991. So what was this project about?
This Human Genome Diversity Project was actually launched as kind of a follow-up project. It would be a way to complete the Human Genome Project by looking specifically at ethnic groups. In 1991, you know, this is early in this kind of new public health initiative to understand health disparities, the project was another international project, another group of different governments coming together to do genomic research and to map human genomes. But this one was vaguely interested in creating some kind of representation of different populations. So the founders of this project were saying, you know, we need to see representation of all of the diversity of the planet. And we don't know that this project that was just launched is going to get at that. So what we want to do is make sure by going to specific places on the planet and making sure to get those genomes. And then we'll also create a repository of these different genomes. And then researchers will be able to, you know, mail in for samples, for DNA samples, and they'll be able to do research that can focus specifically on different groups and different ethnic backgrounds. And so that project started in, as you said, 1991. And in 1993, again, when the National Institutes of Health, you know, instated the policy that it instated to make sure that researchers were using racial categories, specifically the government's racial categories, their set of, you know, five racial categories or four racial categories in one ethnic group. At that point, the Human Genome Diversity Project also started to use the language of the government's Health Disparities Initiative. So they started to talk about getting specifically African Americans involved in the project. And what you see is this move away from just, you know, ethno-linguistic kind of groups. We're going to go around the planet to specifically, we want to make sure that American minorities are included in genomic research.
And how does that accord with at least my understanding that race has proved not to be kind of biologically based and that it's more of a social construction? And so that, and if that is true, then that would suggest that the genomes of different races might not really show much variation.
That's a really good question. Actually, the problem that came up was that the researchers who were leading these genome projects were also making a lot of public statements, increasingly so, where they were saying, especially into the end of the 1990s and around the publication of the Human Genome Draft Map in 2000, saying that the genomes showed that race was a fiction. It was a social reality, but not a biological reality, and that you couldn't just carve up the human, you know, all of the diversity in the world into these racial categories, especially the ones that the governments use. But what was confused in this whole kind of attempt to adhere to the new policies was that research inclusion became such a focus that the same researchers who were saying there is no such thing as biological race, there is no genetic race, were increasingly also arguing for using these specific categories in research. You know, and so what happened was, and this is something that my book Race Decoded really looks at, is that by the early 2000s, using the racial categories of the government, which are largely continental race categories. So they refer back to continental races. By the early 2000s, using a kind of continental schematic for including people into the research endeavor or, you know, into new studies and new projects, that became completely, you know, done in terms of these continental groups. And the whole idea of keeping race out of the mix of genetic research and the new genomics just fell by the wayside.
You also address in your writing this issue of racialized medicine, race-based medicine, and medicine that is offered and distributed and marketed to people of certain races and not others. So Bidal was a drug. And can you tell us about what the makers of this drug intended with it and what they did in the clinical trial stage?
Sure. So Bidal was a heart failure drug, in fact, that was created to reduce the pill burden, what's called the pill burden of taking a couple of pills that help in preventing heart failure. So normally you would go to your doctor if you're at risk for heart failure, and your doctor might prescribe you these two generic drugs. They're two different pills, and the makers of Vital came in and said, we're going to put them both into one pill, and it's going to help, you know, reduce your risk for heart disease, for heart failure, sorry. So what happened is the FDA did not approve this drug application. So they didn't approve Bidil for use by all populations. But the makers of Bidil noticed that in their clinical trials that African Americans were helped a great deal. And there are a lot of details about the ways in which they compared blacks and whites that were kind of fuzzy and funny and don't match up at all. The numbers don't match up. So really, the truth is that the drug does help people of all backgrounds, not just African Americans, but with no approval from the FDA for that specific use and a patent that was about to be over. What happened is the makers decided to conduct a new clinical trial that was focused on African Americans to show efficacy and to say, we're going to prove that this is great for African Americans, and we're going to have a new application that's just going to say we're selling this just to African Americans. And it was successful because the drug works in everybody. So they got a new lease on the patent, you know, and then they got approval in 2005 from the FDA. So what, you know, what happened is race-based medicine became a reality. The actual way that they recruited African Americans for their study, for their clinical trial, was by self-report. So people just, you know, came and said, I identify as African American. There was no kind of, you know, some genetic testing or any kind of population research. It was just, you know, people saying, I'm black, I identify as black. That was the language they used. And so it worked in those people who were deemed black or mm-hmm. African American. And then the makers, Nitromed, they actually got approval to sell this to African Americans. And actually, there were some follow-up interviews and conversations with people who were a part of the study, and some people had changed their racial affiliation, so no longer identified as black. So that's, you know, it just shows that self-identification is something that is important. You know, you have to let people identify themselves, but at the same time, it's not a surefire thing that what you're getting is exactly what you're saying. And then what happened is race-based medicine became something that became normal for the FDA and for biomedicine in general. And there have been other drugs, many drugs, that have also tried to kind of rescue themselves by taking a race-based tack. So saying this drug, which did not get approval, will work specifically in this subpopulation. And the FDA has been, and the U.S. Patent Office has been pretty generous about approving those race-based drugs. So we have many more race-based drugs out there on the market now.
Is Bidil still on the market?
Bidil is, yeah.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Catherine Bliss joins me in studio. She teaches sociology at UC San Francisco. She is author again of Race Decoded, The Genomic Fight for Social Justice. Her research explores the sociology of race, gender, and sexuality in science, medicine, and society. And we're talking specifically about a chapter she contributed to a new volume. It's called Subprime Health. It's edited by Nadine Ellers and Leslie Hinkson. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. What have some bioethicists been pushing for in the area of race-based drugs and medicine?
Most of the conversation around the bioethics of race And this includes race-based medicine, whether to have race-based medicine, whether to prescribe it, whether to promote it, has been around getting people treatment. And so what the standard conversation has focused on is, you know, making sure that health disparities are eliminated by any means necessary, and especially by making sure that racial minorities get the drugs that they need. And so there hasn't been a lot of critical discussion about race-based medicine and about what these companies have been doing as far as rescuing drugs that they otherwise would not be able to sell. And so now we have a few conversations popping up around the country about with a critical perspective, including the volume that we're talking about today, the Subprime Health book. And in that volume, we're a bunch of scholars looking critically at the quick fixes that are being thrown at racial health disparities and all kinds of problems and inequalities having to do with health by race.
Yeah, I mean, some people would be encouraged by this news about racially targeted medicine, about the inclusion of a certain consciousness of race difference in genetic projects, genome sequencing, genetic research. What is your concern? What is your critique around these kinds of issues, which do seem to be moving in a progressive direction because race seems to be more and more of an issue, something to take into consideration, something to implement within these projects?
My issue is with using racial inclusion into studies and projects as a solve for racial health disparities. What happens when you do that is you get all of these studies and projects being stratified by race. And when researchers, so they create these big databases or genomic repositories, cell repositories. And what they do is they create these databanks where researchers from all over the world can, you know, send in for actual DNA samples from which to do their studies. And when those researchers do their studies, they get these samples packaged by race. And so what they end up doing is comparing these by whites or by blacks or doing studies that are focused on one particular race, and that racializes their research. Even if they don't have a real racial motive, you know, and they're not necessarily studying something that has a racial health disparity or shows disparate rates, their research becomes racialized. And so the problem that I see is that, you know, just including by continental categories, which genome scientists have repeatedly noted don't really get at the diversity on the planet and are not a good way to think about genomic diversity.
So these categories are Caucasian, Black, Asian, and I guess Latino, Hispanic would be that ethnic category. And then we're talking about Native Americans as well.
Yes. Those are the categories. And again, they're kind of by continent. So you can think of it as, you know, the African continent, the European continent, the Asian continent. Of course, you know, those are one big continent. But anyways, you know, that's the breakdown. And so what happens is you get these comparisons by continent, and then you don't get any attention to the actual root causes of health disparities, root causes such as differential health care, treatment, or something that I think is even more important as a sociologist, the actual social and built environment, because there are reasons why, you know, there are environmental reasons why some people are going to have higher rates of cancer and why they're going to have more aggressive cancers. And that has to do with where you live, the water, the air that you have around you, not just the kind of healthcare you have access to, but also just, you know, your living and working conditions. Those things are your everyday life. They're what you live on a daily basis. And so to have that not be in the mix of a study that ends up reproducing a sense of difference, but now difference that is genetic or genomic, I think that's really dangerous and it's irresponsible.
Well, you would think that with the emerging focus on race and the compulsion, right? The federal authorities are saying use these categories and look at race and look at racial disparities in your research. You would think then that this research, or at least some of it, would be devoted to the causes of health disparities, like you're saying, the social, environmental, built-in environmental causes of why people, some people are in better health statuses and some people aren't. So is there kind of a lot of research being devoted to not just the straight genomic, medical, biological stuff, but also to the environmental causative stuff that you think as a sociologist they should be interested in large part in a significant way?
Yes, there is a great deal of research that focuses on the social and environmental causes and factors that contribute to health disparities, but that research is not a part of the genomic endeavor. And what I look at is this new science that is, it's not so new anymore, but it is still increasingly prominent and predominant in public health. Genomic research gets the lion's share of funding from all of the different American funding sources. And when you look at the governments around the world that have taken part in genomic research, from those governments as well. So it's a very capital intensive area of research and it gets a lot of money. And so when we look at what is being spent on these different forms of research, genomics is getting way more money than social research. And way, way, way more money. You know, so the issue is that this science that is increasingly coming to stand for what's great about public health and what American public health is doing for its people, it is headed in this direction that is racializing and that is creating a more fixed sense of biological differences on like a continental schematic or a continental axis of difference. It's been a trend for social scientists who are interested in health disparities to pair up with genome researchers and to try to get on some of these studies to get some of the funds and to try to understand health disparities from a gene environment perspective. But that hasn't changed the fact that research inclusion is really what genome scientists are doing here by race. And any social epidemiological research that comes as a part of these studies is limited.
That's Catherine Bliss, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of California, San Francisco. Again, author of Race Decoded, The Genomic Fight for Social Justice. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with her about health disparities and genomics and racialized medicine. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Catherine Bliss is a sociology professor based at the University of California, San Francisco. She's got a forthcoming book due out in 2018 called Social by Nature, The Promise and Peril of Sociogenomics. And we are talking about a chapter, although much of her research has focused on what we are chatting about this hour. The chapter is entitled The Meaning of Health Disparities, and she contributed it to the new volume Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. medicine. So it seems like in today's culture, biomedicine kind of holds us in thrall, right? We are told about all these wonderful advances in science and medicine and how it can improve our lives. And, wow, there's this new medicine for that. And, you know, in some senses, these medicines and some of these treatments are considered, are marketed, are presented as quick fixes to our problems. So do you think that's part of the reason why social science and sociological research and social epidemiology is lagging behind, doesn't get the funding, doesn't get the attention that genomics and kind of straight medical research into genetic sequencing and the like gets?
Definitely. The issue with doing something about the social and built environment is that it is expensive. I mean, you can't just fix the fact that African Americans live in worse living conditions and have worse working conditions on average compared to white Americans. And you can't just fix neighborhoods that have been deprived of good food and deprived of, you know, clean water. These are the most difficult things for governments to fix. Of course, you would hope that they would fix them, but, you know, they're expensive. It's a lot cheaper just to throw pills at people and say, here, your genome looks like this, and so why don't you just take this pill and, you know, stay in your, you know, subprime living conditions and stay in that job that is dangerous for your health and just take this pill and you'll, you know, that's so much cheaper. It's so much easier to do something like that. So I think that there needs to be a national and then hopefully international conversation about these problems. And I want to stress that the people who are doing something about racial disparities and trying to include more groups into science, they have the best intentions. It's not that you have people who are trying to do something bad or, you know, or actually think like, yeah, let's just throw pills at the problems. You know, it's more like this is a big, it's a structural problem and it's a big web work of different institutions and organizations that for various reasons, they have an interest in using the government's racial categories, either by policy mandate or also from interest in doing something about the problem and inadvertently recreating an issue of stratifying by race in a way that later, as I was mentioning, leads to the comparison and kind of a just non-critical look at race being something that's just genetic.
In your work, you've documented some of the conversations between sociologists of race and genetic scientists. So you have these people, and there is a dialogue, right? There are conversations going on. Sociologists are trying to tell these scientists what they might want to focus on or prioritize in their work. Do you get the sense that anything is coming of that in a constructive way, that some of the ideas that people like UC Berkeley's Troy Duster are trying to relate to these people and inform these people about is having an impact on their social consciousness, political consciousness, scientific work?
Definitely, there's an impact, and people like Troy Duster and increasingly I also take part in a lot of conversations with biomedical researchers and genome mappers that are making an impact. So these conversations are creating a consciousness around it. But the outcome of genomic research is going to be focused on the body. So it's going to be things like drugs, drug development. And, you know, even gene environment research, which promises to look at the interaction between genes and the environment. Most studies do not have any kind of analysis of of environmental factors, anything beyond the body. So sometimes a study will say, well, we took into account the person's body mass index or their weight or their how many times they ate meals or something like that. And that's considered the environment. There's nothing about people's living conditions, people's working conditions. And another thing that is really pertinent to health disparities, you know, racism. So, you know, that while many genome scientists who have genome mappers, in fact, the leaders of these projects who have said, you know, we want to understand race better, have also talked about their interest in understanding the biology of racism, that's not really their area that they focus on. So there hasn't been research on that, you know, on gene environment, genomics of racism and all of that. And yeah, the environment keeps being limited to these kinds of easy to ascertain kind of height, weight, health choices, health behaviors, and not the built environment or the relationships that people have and their actual daily life conditions.
What does epigenetics mean, and how is that different from genetics? And does epigenetics research have any promise in terms of elucidating the kind of environmental and social factors you would like to see incorporated into research?
Epigenetics looks at the genetic material that is outside of the genome. So genes are actually comprised of nucleotides. And nucleotides, there are billions of nucleotides in our genome. So like they say about 3.2 billion nucleotides in the entire length of the genetic material in your body. Genes actually are little fragments within all of that whole string of material, right? They're kind of these little islands of genetic material that code for proteins. That's why people have focused on that genetic material as opposed to every single base pair, every single nucleotide that's in our bodies, because those genes actually code for proteins. And we know a lot about proteins. So we know, like, okay, if we develop a drug that inhibits the making of this protein, then, you know, we're going to help with this particular disease or disorder. So for a long time, scholars thought that that other material in the genome or, you know, the entire 3.2 billion nucleotides, that other stuff was junk, and they called it junk DNA. And that is referred to as the epigenome, because it's, you know, not the genes specifically, but it's all the other stuff. And what they found is that it's actually a great deal responsible for the turning on and off of genes. So that's called gene regulation and gene expression. So whether genes are expressed or not. So the other thing that researchers have found is that so-called junk DNA is responsive to the environment, like actually responsive to what you're doing and what kind of care you're getting and what you're eating and how you're sleeping and all of that. So we might have the same genes in our bodies, in our cells, and the same genes are supposed to be making the same proteins, but what ends up happening is mine are turned off in some cells and, you know, yours are turned on in those cells, and then you get these differences. So now there's this move to study the epigenome and to understand how the environment is impacting what our DNA actually does to us. And the issue I find with epigenomics or epigenetics is that it is also still very focused only on the genetic material, on DNA. And whereas it has this promise of understanding how the environment impacts us, most studies just focus on the process of turning on and on off genes, which is called methylation. And so basically they focus on this process and there is no environmental analysis. So this area that's called, it falls under the umbrella of this exciting new focus on genes in their environments, or gene environment research, is not really environmental research at all. It's just genetic research. It's more genetic research. So that's the issue with epigenomics.
That's Catherine Bliss. She teaches sociology at the University of California, San Francisco. She's the author of Race Decoded, and she contributed a chapter entitled The Meaning of Health Disparities to the volume Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. We turn now to one of the editors of Subprime Health. Leslie Hinkson is an assistant professor of sociology at Georgetown University. I spoke with Leslie just before airtime, and I asked her what that volume, which she co-edited with Nadine Ehlers, is basically about.
Well, at its most fundamental level, Subprime Health is actually about thinking about what people have been calling race-based medicine, and trying to sort of conceptualize and operationalize it in what we think of as a much more thorough way. So many times when people think about race-based medicine, they only think about, you know, things like ethnopharmacogenics. So, you know, people creating a drug that is designed specifically for one particular racial or ethnic group, which, you know, many people don't know that this is happening or has happened, but it is, and it's seen as perhaps a wave of the future. We think of it beyond that. You know, it's more than just a little pill. You know, it's also the ways in which different types of people, different types of bodies are treated, you know, in the medical encounter. So it also has to do with, you know, how you're treated, how your doctor treats you. You know, it talks about things like how, you know, doctors are trained to diagnose different types of people differently and treat them, give them different treatments based on their racial identity or what is thought of as their racial identity, you know. And then from there, it's also just the whole healthcare delivery system. You know, we know in this country that, you know, medicine has been rationalized and been rationed along racial lines since the institutionalization of medicine. So that's really what prompted this book, is, you know, trying to think about this in an interdisciplinary fashion and having people that we thought of as doing really innovative things in this area, you know, help us to, in one volume, think about, you know, what is race-based medicine and what are the things we should be most concerned with if we actually do want to try and do things like perhaps, you know, reduce health disparities.
The subtitle of this book is Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. What do you mean by debt in this context?
Yeah, so one of the things that we found when we were thinking about our individual work is that there are multiple ways we could think about debt. So, you know, debt, of course, in its most common form, has to do with monetary debt. So there are a few chapters in the volume that actually deal with monetary debt. You know, what does it mean? What does it mean in a healthcare system that actually does try and treat and diagnose illness along racial lines when race is a biological fiction? You know, how does that actually lead to not only those who are being treated in this fashion going into debt, but also just our whole, you know, system of healthcare delivery actually doing so in such an inefficient way that, you know, we are racking up monetary costs? I mean, if you think about it, this country is probably spends the most on medical care and health care of any other country in the world, and yet, you know, sort of the quality of that care by almost every metric, including mortality and morbidity rates, is actually much lower than you'll see in other developed countries in the world. So there's monetary debt, and there's also, you know, we think about also moral debt. You know, many times when people think about sort of the imperative to actually start, you know, treating different bodies differently at this point in time, it's actually seen as a way to atone for, you know, the past history of medical abuse and medical neglect. And it causes us to think about, well, who owes whom? right, and what is owed. And so, you know, the rest of the volume thinks about things like moral debt and reparative justice and how race-based medicine, you know, in many ways, you know, has been seen as invoking these other kinds of debt as well.
Give me some specifics of some of the other chapters in this volume, what those chapters are about.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I can start with mine. So my chapter actually begins by talking about the subprime mortgage crisis, right? And, you know, that is basically where the title of the volume comes from. One of the things that drove the subprime mortgage crisis, the fact that African Americans and Latinos in particular were actually being, you know, targeted for subprime mortgages, even when their credit scores and the credit histories and their asset-to-debt ratios actually qualified them for prime mortgages, you know, simply because they were just being targeted for their racial and ethnic identities. And that, in large part, is what fueled the subprime mortgage crisis. And my chapter basically says this is actually also part of what is implicit in our rising health care costs here, is black and brown bodies are being targeted for treatments that don't necessarily have anything to do with what ails them or what will treat their ailments the best. And I use the example of hypertension. You know, for at least four decades, you know, it's not a secret. Doctors have been saying that African Americans in particular shouldn't be given certain drugs for their hypertension because supposedly they don't respond as well. And so I basically just do an analysis to show the extent to which this is the case, and also analyses to show that this treatment doesn't really follow any sort of logic, you know, whether guidelines that have been around for years or whether, you know, it has to do with whether the drugs are cheaper or not, because perhaps they believe that, you know, because African Americans tend to be lower income, maybe they don't have health insurance, they can't pay for more expensive drugs, et cetera. So that's one. There's another chapter in there that I co-authored with Ruha Benjamin that looks at trust. You know, and it's based on Ruha Benjamin's field work at a clinic that treats people with sickle cell anemia. And basically, one of the things that she found in her research is that, you know, they're trying to recruit African Americans to be part of these clinical trials for, you know, this cutting-edge treatment, but they can't seem to find enough people to participate in the trials. And one of the tropes that is trotted out very often is that, well, these people, you know, what's wrong with them? We're trying to do something good for them. Why do they lack trust? So this idea that African Americans are devoid of this certain value when, you know, and if only they'd learn to trust, you know, which is a very ahistoric view of the history of medicine and experimentation in the United States. And so, you know, why don't the people operating these trials turn it on themselves and say, well, how can we earn the trust of these people that we actually want to have in our studies? I mean, I could go on and on. There's so many great chapters in this book.
In the conclusion to this book, you and Nadine Ehlers write that the problem with race-based medicine is not that it focuses on the biological, but in that it treats race as a possible biological determinant or root cause trigger of disease, as opposed to thinking of race as predicting the amount of exposure to a series of external stimuli that invoke certain biological responses. So what you are saying here is what you are pointing to here is the importance of environmental factors, right, as opposed to focusing specifically on or exclusively on biology?
Exactly. And I think another way to think about it is, you know, instead of trying to find the pathology within these bodies, you know, I think we should be examining the pathology around which certain types of bodies are forced to live within. So it's not these bodies that are pathological. I mean, racism is pathological. Environmental racism is pathological. The imposition of poverty, right? The imposition of hyper-policing on individuals just because of their quote-unquote racial or ethnic identities, that's pathological.
Leslie Hinkson, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Georgetown University. And again, she is co-editor with Nadine Ellers of the new volume, Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. Leslie, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.